In a landmark class action lawsuit settlement, the Los Angeles City Council agreed to pay nearly $13 million to those injured or mistreated in the 2007 May Day demonstration in MacArthur Park. As the march ended, LAPD riot police were filmed by camera crews using excessive force, firing rubber bullets, and striking people wantonly with batons.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
The new foreign minister for Israel is going to be Avigdor Lieberman. It is basically a fascist party. Lieberman is called, among other things, for the forcible removal of all Palestinians from Greater Israel, force of loyalty oaths for all Israeli citizens of Palestinian descent. It's a bad, bad sign for where Israel is headed.
This week in radical history for the week starting March 30th. Since we're having studio recording problems at Gleegly Studios this week, this week's show is an abbreviated version of what you've come to know and love. And since April 1st is International Pirate Radio Day, we are bringing you an awesome sampling of pirate radio blasts from the past. That'll be at the end of this week's show. Here we go.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
On this day, March 30th, in 1855, on the eve of statewide elections in the U.S. state of Kansas to determine whether or not Kansas would allow slavery, some 5,000 pro-slavery thugs from neighboring Missouri crossed the border to intimidate anti-slavery Kansans and to commit electoral fraud. They were successful for a time in that, with more votes cast than registered voters, a pro-slavery legislature was seated. This was the crucible in which famed abolitionist John Brown earned his reputation as an uncompromising fighter as well as an incorrigible individualist. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lithuania. Anarchist writer, activist, and feminist Emma Goldman lives.
This week in radical history for March 31st,
1986, following a 12-year campaign, a New York City gay rights ordinance is signed, 1990. England. Trafalgar Square poll tax riot. The riot brought into focus the growth in Britain of an underclass seen in collision with symbols of late 1980s wealth. These crystallized political disenchantment.
Tens of thousands of people demonstrated against the poll tax in central London, rallying in Trafalgar Square.
The head of the march was still pouring into the square as the first trouble started in Downing Street. The officer in charge of the operation believes the hardcore wanted to storm Downing Street.
Violence was caused by around 3,000 among them.
At this stage, the square had been turned into a virtual battleground. But running street battles are continuing and have spread to the area around Leicester Square, where cars are being overturned and shop windows are being smashed.
And these riots would topple the Thatcher government. And in 2002, former UN weapons inspector and former US Marine, Scott Ritter, has warned that America will lose the Iraq War and the American military. Quote, "We will leave Iraq with its tail between its legs," unquote. This week in radical history for April 1st. It is International Pirate Radio Day. More on that later in the show. 1649 diggers occupy St. George's Hill, near Cobham, Surrey, seizing land to hold in common and to plant. Other communities follow.
Our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now, against lawyers and against priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath, to grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth, stand up now, diggers all.
The diggers tried to reform by leveling real property and the existing social order with an agrarian lifestyle based on their ideas for the creation of small, egalitarian, rural communities. They were one of a number of nonconformists, dissenting groups that emerged around this time.
Stand up now.
1918, during this month the final issue of Emma Goldman's Mother Earth Bulletin is produced. Future publication is made impossible by ongoing government seizures. 1938 in Spain. The Lincoln Brigade is overrun by the fascist armies near Gandesa. The battalion suffers heavy casualties. The Lincoln Brigade was comprised of US and other internationals fighting the fascists during the Spanish Civil War. Perhaps most noted fighter was George Orwell. He would write Homage to Catalonia about his war experiences as the democracy-loving US rushes to recognize the fascist dictatorship.
This Week in Radical History for April 2nd,
1908 in Rome, during a funeral for a worker who died in an industrial accident, confrontations occur with the police, who oppose the procession. Police open fire, killing 4 and wounding 17. Among the dead is the anarchist militant Paolo Chiarelli. A general strike is declared, and subsequently, several anarchists are arrested, tried and condemned to heavy prison sentences. 1969, 21 Black Panther Party members are charged with conspiring to kill cops, bomb New York City stores, and trying to blow up police stations. 13 are prosecuted in September. After an 8-month trial, the jury took only 2.5 hours to vote to acquit.
This is your Radio Root supporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 4th, in 1859, a popular blackface minstrel show in New York called Bryant's Minstrels debuted the song I Wish I Was in Dixieland, which promoted the idea that enslaved black people were happy, content, and actually longed to be on plantations. The song became an instant hit, especially in the South, where it gave voice to the pre-Civil War sentiments of Southern whites. Just 2 years later, the Dixie Song became the battle hymn of the Southern Confederacy as they marched into Civil War to defend the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it.
1900, Prince of Wales escapes anarchist assassination attempt. 16-year-old Jean Baptiste Cipido takes 2 shots at the prince in the Brussels railway station in protest against the Boer War, apprehended, but acquitted July 5th.
People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 5th in 1621, the Mayflower left the Plymouth colony where it had landed 1 year earlier in order to return to England. The English had begun the colonization of North America in the 1580s by building small colonies along the Atlantic coast, including the successful Jamestown settlement that was founded in 1607. Because the agricultural economies of these early colonies demanded large labor forces, white settlers first used enslaved Native Americans and European indentured servants. Over time, the labor of enslaved Africans proved to be the most economical, and the development of chattel slavery began. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it.
1983 El Salvador. 2 members of a Christian community in San Ramon are abducted, tortured and shot by the national police. In September, U.S. trained death squads will bomb the Jesuit residence in San Salvador.
Okay, a brief history of events that have happened this coming week. Now onto a celebration of International Pirate Radio Day, which, fitting enough, is April 1st. The following is a 9-minute segment produced by the Emergence Broadcasting System, and it is audio portion of a Renegade Art installation opening up this Monday, March 30th. The Squatted House in Bushwick is an art space, and one of these pieces of art that are in display is a pirate radio theme. So this is 9-minute audio that is looping in this particular small corner of the space, and it is all about the history and sounds of pirate radio. And since pirate radio is radical and historical, well, I thought I'd bring a piece of it to you right now. So if you find yourself in the Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn, maybe we'll see you there, huh? Here's that audio.
Oh. If anything you hear on this radio station offends you in any way over the next 3 hours, please change the channel or turn the f***ing thing off.
Attention, America, this is not for you.
It's a total communications revolution. This is a lot like the printing press, which was illegal. That was a contraband item.
This is a test.
Turn on down and put the handcuffs on us. The feeling what we're doing is so damn wrong.
This is not a test.
The most dangerous frequency is an installation of pirate radio transmissions going back over 35 years. Pirates say dead men tell no tales, but this is not true when it comes to pirate radio stations. Now, many of our comrades have fallen. Their messages continue to reach out. In fact, radio is an endless medium. A radio wave continues. The radio signal continues even after the transmitter and the person transmitting is long since gone. The two-dimensional radio wave carries on. In fact, the first radio signals ever done can still be heard in outer space. This installation hopes to bring you the voices of the past, the disembodied rebellion in audio format. Please stay tuned to listen to your irregularly scheduled program. This installation is brought to you by the Emergent Broadcasting System.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's the Caroline Flashback.
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
What is this? I mean, you guys don't have any commercials? Is this a real station?
Well, what this is a pirate station.
Illegal.
Illegal?
You've just crossed over from reality and entered the Rabbit Zone.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3.
96.3 FM.
101.1 on your FM dial has been successfully flying the skull and crossbones for the past 10 years.
They say the free radio movement is just too big to stop.
101.1 FM and free radios.
The best damn station in the country, and it's all for you.
Right, 89.3,
you skid my car, free radio.
I don't consider myself a communist, no. Have you ever said fuck the FCC?
Oh, hello.
This is Radio POE. As from the 29th of October 2000, this station will be broadcasting in one session between 7 p.m. and 7:55 p.m. every night. Our address remains the same, but CY3093, Corsair in Harare. Radio VOP, voice of the people. Manaru Taura, the people are talking. Arantibara Kuluma.
They run a pirate radio station in Brooklyn, New York.
Well, unfortunately, troops, it's that time again for good old Pete and myself. We've just about reached the ending of another radio first summer for tonight. And we'd like to leave you with a few closing thoughts. First off, remember, there is no black power or white power in Vietnam. There's only one power, and that's rabbit power. Another thought, when you go downtown, be sure to take enough rubbers along in case you want to go for two or three or four or five or six or seven like Pete does. Well, Pete, I've enjoyed it. It's been another fantastic night of cutting the Air Force to pieces and saying nasty things on the air. And hopefully, if we're not thrown in jail by tomorrow night, we'll be able to come back again at 8 o'clock and blow your mind with...
Ma è semplicissima, è lineare, cristallina. Questi signori stanno esagerando e bisogna farli smettere. Ne ho parlato anche con l'amico Lama. È tempo di fare qualcosa. Lei forse non sente i loro slogan, ma in questo preciso momento stanno manifestando giù in strada. E lo sa? Lo sa cosa dicono?
For steel, this radio.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Frequency is 99.5 FM.
Worldwide revolution here, folks.
101.1 on your FM dial has been successfully flying the skull and crossbones for the past 10 years.
Take a stop.
The pirate ships are sailing out on stormy seas.
Un programa de la Que Huelga Radio, un radio pirata transmitido desde la huelga estudiantil de 1999.
Ya que están en los anuncios, ya que se fueron con todo, pues ahí en el mensajero nos anunciaban que desde nuestros corresponsales de Houston, sí, bueno, en la banda de Houston, que el día de mañana va a haber una protesta enfrente del Consulado de México a las 9 de la mañana.
Somewhere in the Mediterranean, we are the voice
of the most dangerous frequency is an installation illustrating the role pirate radio has played in contested space. It seeks to connect the present struggles and occupations in New York with over three decades of struggle in audio transmissions in this country and around the world. In the world of cable news, blogs, YouTube, and Twitter, there is still a place for clandestine radio broadcasts. That place is in the contest over the liberation of space. The airways have always been undifferentiated space, a whisper of electrons that comes from somewhere else, speaking to an unseen audience, unmitigated and uncontrolled. Radio is the medium of choice for work and driving, specifically because it allows a duality of attention unlike any other medium. For the rebel, this duality is crucial. It allows the listeners to receive and act simultaneously. In fact, live radio is perhaps the most intimate and immediate of all forms of broadcasting, and thus there will always be a place for it in the passionate struggle for liberation. Pirate radio played a role in the anarchist movement in Spain, broadcasting well into the 1960s. It also played a role during the May riots, 1968 in France, and in Tiananmen Square, and to this very day. You will hear 30 years of rebel yells in this installation, which, in of itself, is located in contested space. At the same time, this installation will be transmitting, thus making it technically a pirate radio station in of itself. Here's a brief list of the pirate radio stations that have operated in New York since 1962 to today. Radio Free Harlem, King Kong Radio, Steal This Radio, Radio Pinko, KOS Radio, Fuck FCC Broadcasting League, the East Side Anarchy Air, Radio Clandestine, Pumpkin Radio, Voice of the Purple People, Falling Star Brooklyn, The Bums, Falling Star Queens, Guerrilla Radio, Radio Liberation, and many, many more. Long live anarchy. Squat the city. Squat the airwaves.
Okay, that was a little piece of Pirate Voices over 35 plus years. Radical voices from around the world. Speaking of Radical Voice, a new down group is offering information about what is happening at the G8 in England, as well as a bunch of other funky stuff. Check out dissidentisland.org for their many offerings. They look to be a bunch of radical punks, and I mean that in the most loving way. That's dissidentisland.org. That's it for this week in Radical History. Sorry about the studio problems. We'll have that under control and back to normal, subnormal show next week. Lots of thanks to give out tonight. As always, the Radio Roots crew, Neighborhood Network in Columbus, thanks for the audio. Thanks to the Rad Info from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. And, of course, the Slingshot organizer who brought me the inspiration to expand on their awesome work. Well, you know the score, folks. Until next week, I'm always fully and radically yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Like a monkey ready to be shot into space. Space monkey. Ready to sacrifice himself for the greater good.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلاد.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we deal with the contrasting Palestinian and Zionist narratives that drive the debate on the Israel-Palestine struggle. Each week we begin this program with an introduction that claims that the purpose of This Week in Palestine is to present the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is so often missing in the Israel-Palestine discussion and analysis in the American media and within the American Academy. The two narratives often clash in various forums where the differing narratives are presented and debated. This week we present illustrative portions of two such forums. In the first forum, the Palestinian narrative is presented by Ilan Pappe, and the second by Norman Finkelstein. Israeli historian Ilan Pappe is one of the greatest assets that we, who try to project the Palestinian narrative, have. That is because he is an impeccable historian. His book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, meticulously documents the expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of over 350 Palestinian villages as Israel took their land and declared the State of Israel. Other historians have documented the ethnic cleansing as well. And while historical interpretations may vary, the facts of the ethnic cleansing have been well established, documented from the archives of the Israeli military. What sets Pappe apart is his willingness to challenge the Zionist false narrative in forums throughout the world, to expose himself to the slings and arrows of those who denigrate his work and try to discredit the Palestinian narrative, which, as we will see, is standing up well to international scrutiny and increasingly being accepted by the international community. The first feature presentation on This Week in Palestine is a recording of a portion of a forum presented on a television program called Q&A, broadcast in Australia, where the Zionist narrative was defended against Pape's historical fact-based analysis. You, the listener, are once again at a bit of a disadvantage trying to follow the conversation when you cannot see the participants. But I think that it becomes quite clear which narratives are being defended at any given moment. Ilan Pappe is the major presenter of the Palestinian narrative, and an attorney by the name of Irving Wallach is the major defender of the Zionist narrative. There are three other participants, Greg Sheridan, Glover Moore, and Robin Davidson, who chip in comments along the way. The portion of this forum you will hear is from the question and answer period and begins with a question from a young Palestinian woman.
Our next question comes from Janine Abdul-Khalik.
My question is for Ilan Pappe. I am of Palestinian descent. My parents were refugees, my grandparents refugees, and my great-grandparents refugees. The state of Israel was established on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the displacement of three-quarters of the Palestinian population. Palestinians have since been subjected to apartheid and a military occupation and the continued confiscation of their land and resources. How can we confront the popular pro-Israel narrative that Israel's a democracy?
Ilan Pappe, you seem to have devoted much of your life to confronting this narrative.
Thank you for this very important question. And indeed, that's a very good question. How can one oppose a narrative that is so hegemonic, that is accepted by such a powerful coalition? So many people in the West accept it. So many people among the Jewish and the Christian communities accept it. And, of course, most of the Israeli Jews accept it. And that's a powerful coalition. And I think that the way to challenge a narrative which is false, which in fact serves as a basis for the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestine. As you are aware, the ethnic cleansing has not stopped in 1948. It still continues as we speak today. The best way is, first of all, to inform people about the truth, about what happened. And I think many more academics than ever before in the Western world are now telling the truth about what happened in Palestine. What once used to be the narrative just a few Palestinians is quite frankly the accepted narrative in most academic institutions in the world. Mainstream media in the West finds it very difficult to accept the narrative, although they know that this is the true narrative.
Can I just pause your narrative just there for a moment? Your early work as an historian, in a way, is what got you into trouble with the Jewish authorities, the academic authorities and other authorities. It was about uncovering what you believe were documents about what actually happened in 1948 and what you've described as the village files. I think in order to understand the argument better, you should tell us what the village files are exactly. Indeed. And how they pertain to this argument.
Yes, definitely. The Jewish establishment before the creation of the State of Israel has prepared a file on every Palestinian village and neighborhood in Palestine, so as to prepare the Jewish forces when the opportunity would come for taking over these villages. And the files had a map, an aerial photography, and a very detailed explanation of what to expect once the village would become Jewish property, in terms of wealth, in terms of number of people, and what to accept in terms of resistance. I think what it showed to me as an historian, and that refers to the question, that part of the missing narrative, if you want, was the systematic preparation of the Zionist movement for the expulsion of the Palestinians in 1948.
You describe this, and this where this comes from our questioner, you describe it as a plan for ethnic cleansing, but is there actual evidence for this, and what do other historians in Israel say when confronted with the documents that you say proves this?
Right. Well, I think there are 5.5 million Palestinian refugees who are the evidence that the ethnic cleansing took place. You don't need documents for that.
Well, I mean, we can go through the detail of that in a moment, but there was obviously a war.
And every Palestinian, every Jewish settlement in Israel is built on the ruins of a Palestinian settlement.
Tony, that's another evidence. I think we need to refer to some facts rather than polemic. And the point is that everyone misses is that the real tragedy of 1947 and 1948 was that there was no Palestinian state established. That's the tragedy, and once you realise that's the starting point, then the refugee problem of what happened flows from there. The United Nations proposed a partition plan, which there'd be a Palestinian state established alongside a Jewish state. Now the problem is, and the problem was, that literally from the day after, and I say this not with any degree of joy, but it's a note of the tragedy. From the day after, the Palestinian people announced forcefully and without reservation that they rejected the plan. They rejected the concept of having a Jewish state next to a Palestinian state. Had they accepted the plan, had they accepted the two-state solution then the opportunity for the war and for what happened afterwards would never have arisen. And what happened was that on December the 2nd, 1947, there was a general strike proclaimed in Jerusalem. There were riots, Jewish shops, people were attacked. The Palestinian leader at the time, the Haj Amin al-Husseini, was a man who had spent the war years, and don't forget this is 1947, this is 2.5 years after the end of World War II. The Palestinian leader, Haj Amin al-Husseini, was a man who had spent the war years in Berlin being photographed shaking hands with Hitler.
Now, I think this is exactly the narrative that we want to interrupt and disrupt, and even if it's presented by an articulate barrister, doesn't make it truth. These are sheer lies.
Excuse me, Ilan.
You are lying. It's a pity.
Excuse me. I think we need to keep the language to firstly respectable level, and secondly to an objective level. Any person here can go to the internet the minute you leave the studio, Google Haj Amin al-Husseini, and what comes up on Wikipedia, on any other number of sites, are photographs of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, shaking hands with Hitler, overseeing and congratulating the raising of German army units amongst Muslims, and secondly, a Waffen-SS unit named after Palestinians and after Muslims. Now, I don't say that anything flows from that other than this shows who the Palestinians' leadership were. And these were the people who started a war in 1947.
Okay, all right, let's settle this issue of the Mufti of Jerusalem, because I've seen those pictures. Seen the history. He was connected to Hitler. There isn't any doubt about that, is there?
Stupid behavior by a Palestinian leader does not justify the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. A Palestinian refusal to accept the partition plan may be justified, maybe not be justified. What is not justified is punishing the Palestinians by depopulating half of the people. We have to understand what happened in 1948. Imagine half of the population of a country was forcefully expelled. Half of the villages of the country were destroyed. Half of the towns were demolished. Now, is this the right punishment for the wrong vote in the United Nations? Is this the right punishment for a leader who made a stupid mistake during the Second World War? This is not a tragedy. 1948 is a crime against humanity.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. We've got a couple of other questioners. We're going to go to Marianne Fraser.
After all the pogroms throughout the centuries, with Jews never being able to own land in any country they lived in, and being forced from their homes time and time again, as portrayed so well in my favourite musical, Fiddler on the Roof, and after the horrors of the Holocaust, isn't it just for Jews to have been given a place to call their own.
Ilan.
You know, it always reminds me about people who would look for a safe place for battered women or abused children. And in order to find the safe place, they would go to a home where another family lives, throw them out of the balcony in order to make a safe haven for the escaped people. Of course, the Jews were entitled to have a safe place. And in many ways, the Palestinians were willing to give them a safe place. What they were not willing to give them is the right to take over their homeland. I think there's a difference between giving a refuge, which for some reason you Australians refuse to give to these poor boat people, then and a group of people who come. Imagine if these boat people today would have knocked on the door of Australia and said, my dear people of Australia, 2,000 years ago it used to be my homeland. You have to give me half of it now and a third of it later on. This will never be accepted by anyone okay. in Australia, and rightly so.
One of our questioners, well, no, someone's got a hand up there. I'll just go to the young woman with a hand up. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Referring to before, you were speaking about the Palestinian leader.
I'm sorry.
Oh, behind me?
It was actually behind you.
Oh, go. Sarah, sorry.
Sorry, yeah. There you go.
In light of what the lady had said, why is it that other people and nations like the Kurds, Assyrians, and Gypsies were not given their right place of a homeland? And why was there a special privilege to the people of the Jewish land? We have a greater problem here that needs to be addressed, that is well-founded and rooted in the establishment of borders in 1920. And this is a problem that is larger than what it looks like.
Okay, let's go to Greg Sheridan here. I've kept the other panel out of the debate because it's been focused on two people on the panel, but I want to hear from the rest of the panellists.
Haven't I been magnificently silent through all that debate? It's the longest debate on Israel ever held in Australia in which I haven't spoken, you know. You'll be astonished
and
to hear
that I...
you're
going to spend your first minute talking about that.
I comprehensively reject Ilan's narrative of Israel. I think it's wrong in every respect. I haven't had time to read all Ilan's books, but I read this week devastating critiques of them by historians who are very critical of Israel in all their factual inaccuracy. Benny Morris, many other historians who are very, very critical of Israel, not servants of the Israeli government. Now, the other thing I would reflect on, no other nation in the world constantly has its legitimacy questioned in the way Israel does. It's the object of Western policy to reassure North Korea that we accept its legitimacy. We accept the legitimacy of Iran. The Americans have gone out of their way to say we're not trying to destroy your nation or even change your regime. It's the most extreme regime in the world racing to a nuclear weapon. Saudi Arabia funds extremism all over the world. The gentleman earlier was talking about hostile international forces funding extremism. Israel is a struggling democracy which makes mistakes, including moral mistakes, and deserves to be called on them. But no country in the world is subject to this attack at the root of its legitimacy that it should not exist. I spend a lot of time in the Middle East, a lot of time in Muslim countries. There is no country in the Middle East which better observes human rights of all of its citizens than Israel.
Okay, I want to hear from the rest of our panels. Before we do that, we have a video from Lawrence Gluck in North Bondi, New South Wales.
I am a regular viewer of Q&A and find that many interesting topics are discussed. However, seldom is a Jewish perspective offered. How ironic is it, therefore, that when a topic of significant relevance to the Jewish community is presented, it coincides with one of the holiest days of the Jewish calendar, Rosh Hashanah. This therefore prevents observant Jews from being able to attend as members of your audience, or even to watch the broadcast, and to add to that useful barometer of public support or condemnation, namely the Twitter chatter. Thank you.
Okay, first of all, this is the only night that Ilan Pappe was available to come on Q&A. A lot of people have made this same point, but we thought it was an important debate and should go on anyway. Irving Wallach is here from the Jewish community. I'm interested to know, just get your reflections on what that gentleman just said, because we have got a lot of mail on this.
Yes. Look, I have to say that when I was invited to come on to Q&A, it was turned out to be this night, caused a minor sensation at home, and at which there were several glasses dropped along the lines of, you're what? You're going on television on the night of Rosh Hashanah. And I said, yes, I was. So it is a point, and it is a real shame that it has come up on this night, because a lot of people that I've talked to in synagogue today wanted to participate in things or possibly go to the audience and obviously to take part in the program. Look, can I say this about Ilan's whole point of view? And that is this. It is designed and intended to perpetuate a conflict model and a conflict narrative. Now, it's all right to go around flinging words such as ethnic cleansing when there are no documents that can be used and relied on to say there was ethnic cleansing. There was a war, and that happened and started in 1947. There have been attempts by both sides, and they've come close in 2000, 2001, and then 2008 to actually settle this on a real cooperative two-state basis. Now, if you want to go on and carry on in the fashion that Ilan does and throw about the clichés and the accusations, then a couple of things follow. Firstly, you have to seriously consider surrendering your claim to be an objective historian. Secondly, what has to be done is that you have to consider and accept that what you are wanting to do is to encourage ongoing conflict and battles and death and destruction between the Israeli people and the Palestinian people. If you want to go along the conflict road, then forget about peace. If you want to promote Israel as a so-called pariah state for your own political and ideological agenda, go ahead. History will not thank you for it.
Ilan,
can I respond? First of all, about the legitimacy of Israel. I think Israel is not seeking a legitimacy. Israel is seeking a legitimacy as being a racist state within the civilized community of states.
Please,
I didn't interrupt you. You taught me a lesson about being polite, so try to apply it to yourself. Now, Israel wants to remain a racist state and a democratic state. This is an oxymoron. I met some Australian oxymorons. I won't outstretch my hospitality. But this is an oxymoron. Secondly, the documentation for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, for Israeli criminal policies since 1948 are there. In fact, most Israeli historians recognize them. The debate in Israel is not factual. The debate in Israel is moral. Whether it was right to do so, as Benny Morris says, in self-defense, to ethnically cleanse another people, or it wasn't moral. I think it was immoral, not Jewish and inhuman.
But what's being challenged here is the documentation, as in historian.
Documentation is not challenged. Nobody challenges the documentation.
Tony, if I might say something, is the slur of an ethnic cleansing as opposed to war, followed by refugees. That's what's under challenge.
Yes. Now,
and in that regard, Ilan is on his own as regards the new historians.
I'm totally alone in it with another 5 to 6 million Palestinians and another 10 billion people in the world. Now, the point that I'm making...
There are only 6 billion
people. 6 million, that's right. I extended it to the universe, I'm sure. I'm sure even aliens understand that the Zionist version is wrong. Now,
I'm going to get you to sum the point up because we haven't heard from at least two of our panelists.
I know, but let me just... Yeah. Really, just the final point, which is very important. By the time the so-called war started, in the 15th of May 1948, when Arab armies entered Palestine, already half of the Palestinians became refugees. So Palestinians became refugees before the war, not because of the war. And in fact, this was the plan, and this is the kind of an unpleasant reality that the Israelis would have to come to terms with so that Jews and Arabs could live in peace and reconciliation. Any other avenue would perpetuate the conflict forever.
Clover Moore, you've sat very patiently through this, and so has Robin. I want to hear from both of you now.
Well, I just think that history's fine, and I acknowledge that there have been terrible experiences of the Jewish people during particularly the Hitler era and for Palestinians as well. But, you know, I think we really should be talking about solutions here. I think of the families of the two communities, and you know, and then the bloodshed that continues to that they the,
the terrible trauma that those experience, those families of those communities experience, and I really think we should be all working very hard to try and find solutions.
Robin.
Well, yes, of course, try to find solutions. Not so easy.
Can I just add that Europeans came to this country 200 years ago. The Aboriginal community had been in this country for 60,000 years. Now, the Europeans dispossessed the Aboriginal people of their land, and we're now working very hard on reconciliation and making amends. And I really think reconciliation and coexistence and solutions for the Palestinian and Israeli communities is what should be the goal of everyone involved in this issue.
Very briefly, are you equating Aboriginal dispossession with Palestinian dispossession?
I think it's comparable, yes.
Robin.
Great. I hope you will be re-elected despite all this.
It's obviously comparable, and I think Australians still don't, I mean, European Australians, the rest of us, in other words, still don't really understand what it means to have been dispossessed in that way. And our good life depends upon that dispossession, and therefore redress must be made. As regards Israel and Palestine, my God, you know, what a horrible debate it is, really. It strikes me there's been a lot of talk recently about Israel being like South Africa, and I think there is a case to be made there. But what it strikes me, the tragedy that it strikes me, is that neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians have thrown up a visionary leader like Mandela, who could provide a vision for that, for those two entities to come together in some way that isn't just the same old tribal nightmare.
Irving, well, do you accept that? I mean, could there emerge ever on either side of politics in the Middle East a leader that could actually overcome this dreadful rift, these divisions, with some form of compromise?
In the future, I believe we can, because the basis for compromise has already been laid. As I said, the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians have come very close on four, possibly five occasions. But can I say this about this question of Aboriginal people? My first job as a solicitor was with the South Coast Aboriginal Legal Service a while ago now. One of the things that surprised me was the number of my clients, Koori's, Aboriginal people, who came up to me at different times when I was working there and said, mate, we appreciate what you're doing. We feel just like you and your people, the Jews. We went through exactly what you're going through. Now, in terms of relations between Jews and Palestinians, all I can tell you from the Aboriginal side of things are the number of times Aboriginal people came up to me and said how they identified with Jewish people.
Tony, could I add one footnote about this question of refugees? The only reason we get these extraordinary numbers for Palestinian refugees is because every descendant unto the ages of the Palestinians is classed as a refugee, unlike every other refugee case in history or in contemporary life. So if you're a Palestinian, you go to live in Jordan, your son is born there and then he has a son there and the son becomes a successful businessman, is a Jordanian citizen and enters the Jordanian cabinet, he is still a refugee. That doesn't apply
anywhere else. There are
800,000
Jews. Can we just get on the table then how many refugees
Just let me finish this point. There were 800,000 Jews who were forced in violent fashion out of Arab lands at about that same time. Now, you could claim, therefore, that there are 5 million Jewish refugees from Arab countries. Nobody does that because there's no political interest in maintaining this fiction of refugees.
Can I just refer to the point that every person who's born a Jew has a right to go and live in Israel?
If you were forced out of Morocco because you were Jewish, your grandson, who is a cabinet minister in Israel, does not qualify as a refugee. But in the Palestinian case, your grandson, who is a cabinet minister in Jordan, is still classified actively by the United Nations as a refugee.
OK, let's hear from you. He makes a valid point about the numbers. So how many were there originally?
Well, first of all, we have we can trust or mistrust the United Nations, but the United Nations is the one that gives us the number of 5.5. So I trust the United Nations on this. Secondly, it's very important to understand that Palestinians would be the first one to support the right of Jews who left or were kicked out of Arab countries to return. I don't know of any Jew that supports the right of the Palestinians to return.
Right, and, I'm going to interrupt your flow. There was a gentleman with his hand up there for quite a while. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. We keep speaking about the history in 1948 and that. I was privileged enough to work in Israel and Palestine for the last 18 months. And I was even able to go into a meeting with the current mayor of Jerusalem. And at the time, he just announced 5,000 more Jewish settlements in East homes in East Jerusalem. And when we questioned him about that, he actually laughed and said, I've only announced 5,000, but there's actually 90,000 planned. So it's still going, and it is ethnic cleansing, as far as I'm concerned, from my first-hand experience.
Well, to come back
to your question, and that is, how many refugees were there in 1947? There were 700,000 refugees, not 5.5 million, and this is something which I think Ilan, I'm afraid, has been quite reluctant to answer. There were 700,000 refugees. There was a civil war that started, the major feature of which was the Palestinian besieging and cutting off of Western Jerusalem, in which, and that was followed ultimately later in 1947 by the expulsion of the Jewish population of the old city of Jerusalem.
Okay, now I just would like you to now to address the question just raised from the floor.
Which is?
Well, do you want to repeat your question?
Well, when I spoke to the mayor of Jerusalem, I asked him about the recent 5,000 homes that he just announced, and he laughed and said, actually, it's 90,000. We just haven't announced that full figure yet.
Can I tell you this?
And that was just last year, mate.
Can I tell you this, that if you're asking me, my view is that what's needed to be done is to progress straight away with the two-state solution. The establishment of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, as far as I'm concerned, is an absolute priority. It's a priority for the Palestinians and it's a priority for Israelis. The occupation, and there has been partial evacuation, partial withdrawal by the Israelis of the West Bank, total withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, but in my view, what is needed is an end to all this occupation. We need a peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We need a Palestinian state alongside Israel. There's no substitute for it, and that needs to be done now, full stop.
Okay, I'm just going to quickly go around the panel because we've run out of time. Greg Sheridan, first of all, just some summary comments.
Well, you know, what a wonderful range of subjects we've traversed, but I certainly believe, as a foreign editor, that Israel is as civilised and decent a country as any country that I visit, and under terrible provocation, it tries very hard to behave morally. It doesn't always succeed. It has a range of independent institutions which hold things accountable. And I think the bizarre focus on the undoubted injustices within Israel of the world, to the exclusion of the terrible human rights abuses all over the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, is a bit weird.
Ilan.
I think the rest of the world would be able to treat much better the abuses of human rights and other atrocities that occur in the Middle East if it will see a transparent Western position towards the atrocities that Israel committed in the past and commits in the present. And in fact, only a genuine democracy in which every Jew, Muslim and Christian would have equal rights and democratic rights is the basis for a future solution. Israel today does not grant these rights. Israel in the future will not grant this right. What we need is a different political outfit which would respect the human rights and the civil rights of everyone who lives between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean and everyone who was expelled from that country.
Robin.
I can't better that.
Sorry?
I can't better that.
Furthermore.
Well, as I said before, I think we should be looking for a solution, and I think we should be looking for reconciliation, and I think a democracy where everyone is treated equally is clearly what we should be looking for.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for tonight. Please thank our panel, Greg Sheridan, Ilan Pappe, Clover Moore, Robin Davidson and Irving Wallach.
You have been listening to a portion of a forum which took place in Australia on a television program called Q&A featuring historian Ilan Pape, who wrote The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, defending the Palestinian narrative against the Zionist narrative articulated by Irving Wallach and Greg Sheridan. The second clash of narratives we present this morning features Daniel Pollack of the Zionist Organization of America challenging professor and author Norman Finkelstein, who argues the Palestinian narrative. This portion of the broadcast is excerpted from a program on the RT television network and downloaded from YouTube.
Well, the implications of this annual conference are enormous every year. But this one in particular, with the Arab Spring and also recent new partnerships in the Middle East and an overall changing mood. There is so much that can be said about all of this, of course, and certainly there are some strong opinions on all sides. Well, to give us a few of those opinions, I'm joined here in studio by Dan Pollack, co-director of government relations for the Zionist Organization of America, and in our New York studio, Norman Finkelstein, political scientist and also author of This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. And, you know, as we start this discussion, I think it's going to be important to clarify a few different things. Now, when it comes to Middle East peace, and Dan, I will start with you, what is acceptable? What, I mean, are you willing to negotiate, and what would you be willing to give up or give in on?
Well, to begin with, I work for an American organization, not the Israeli government, but the Israelis are extremely anxious to have peace. At this AIPAC conference, about all they talk about is peace and how it should be achieved. So peace is the ultimate objective of everyone I know in Israel on both sides of the political spectrum. The problem is about what the conflict is really about. And the United States, in formulating issues relating to territory, is not getting to the core issue. The core issue, in my view, and probably in the view of most Israelis, is the inability of the Arab world and the Palestinians to accept the very existence of a Jewish state in the midst of the Middle East. And until that issue gets satisfied, all the talk of potential border resolutions and all the other things that are being focused on really don't get us towards that end of peace.
And I think President Obama even mentioned that in his speech at AIPAC yesterday, that it is absolutely, you know, essential that people from Israel are negotiating with others who recognize them. However, on the other side of that, people in Palestine think the same thing. They want to be recognized as their own state, and they don't feel like they are. So, Norman, I'll have you speak to that, you know, the recognition of what each side is.
The basic principles for resolving the conflict have been put forth repeatedly by the international community, whether it be the International Court of Justice in July 2004 or the United Nations General Assembly in annual resolution. The terms are straightforward. There has to be a two-state settlement on the June 1967 border, Israel exercising sovereignty and independence within its state, and the Palestinians exercising sovereignty and self-determination in the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem as its capital. And there also has to be a just resolution of the Palestinian refugee question. Those are the terms. Now, Ken has added a new term. He says that Israel has to be recognized as a Jewish state. But there's no basis of that for that in international law. And in fact, your listeners have to remember, this is not the first time Israel has attempted to settle its conflict with its neighbors. They have a peace treaty with Egypt. It was signed in 1979. They have a peace treaty with Jordan. It was signed in 1994. In neither case, if you read the texts of these peace treaties, in neither case is there any mention of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Mr. Pollack is simply pulling this rabbit out of the hat, another means to sabotage a resolution of the conflict on the basis of the law.
I'll let you respond to that, Dan.
I really couldn't disagree more with several points. First of all, the international law that applies here is UN Resolution 242, which does not require that all of the disputed territory of what Israelis called Judea and Samaria and what the Dr. Finkelstein called the West Bank be given to the Palestinians. In fact, it's disputed territory. The Palestinian negotiating ploy seems to be what's yours is negotiable and what's mine is mine. As he said, in its entirety, everything has to be part of the Palestinian state. In fact, that is precisely what needs to be negotiated. And it is the Arab side who has steadfastly refused to enter into negotiations, direct negotiations, that could lead to any kind of peaceful resolution. So he's wrong about the international law that applies. The General Assembly does not determine international law. So the fact that they say that Jerusalem should be the capital of the Palestinian state.
But don't you think, Dan, when you say that the Palestinians have said that they're not willing to give anything? I mean, we saw with the Palestinian papers, we saw with a lot of different things that have happened and have come out in the last few months, that in fact, at least the Palestinian leaders have been willing to put just about everything on the table when it comes to negotiating. And there's just a few things that they've asked for from Israel that don't seem to be, no one seems to be budging on.
Well, actually, those papers were transcripts of the Palestinian side of negotiations from several years ago. And there's two important facts to know about that. First of all, they haven't put anything on the table. They haven't agreed to even sit down with the Israelis and discuss things through the vast majority of the Obama term. But secondly, the reason those Palestinian papers made such news is that the Palestinian negotiators have been withholding these very negotiating positions from their own people. And in fact, they disavowed them and still claim to this day that those very concessions about allowing some Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem to remain under Israeli control, they denied that they ever made such concessions. Now, I would be very pleased if a Palestinian negotiating team would return to the table with Israel and start negotiating on whatever basis, and I would be pleased if they would actually observe the agreements they've made in the past, which require them to stop incitement against the Jewish state. And finally, I would be pleased if they would choose peace instead of the Fatah-Hamas agreement, where they've just made an agreement over the last 2 weeks with Hamas, which is a terrorist state as defined by the European Union and the United States, a terrorist entity, and not helpful neither to American diplomacy in the region nor the prospects of peace.
And we should mention that Hamas and Fatah are meeting in Moscow to talk about this, and it is not, Hamas is not called a terrorist organization by everyone, not by Moscow and not by the United Nations, I believe. But still, Moscow has asked Hamas, and I'll let you get in here in just a second, but let's talk about what's going on here. Moscow has asked Hamas consider recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Does this have to happen? And if it does happen, what would be the result?
Norm. Well, I think there are three things to be said. First of all, as I mentioned a moment ago, there is no precedent in international law, and there's no precedent in the peace treaties Israel has already signed with Egypt or Jordan for recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Number two, everybody talks about what Hamas has to do, but what about what Israel has to do? The very same day, last Friday, when President Obama delivered his speech on the Middle East, the New York Times ran a large op-ed by the Deputy Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, who also happens to be a senior member of the Likud party, Mr. Netanyahu's party. Now, bear in mind, the Likud is the most moderate element of Netanyahu's coalition. So we're not talking about extremists like Avigdor Lieberman. We're talking about the moderate Likud. And in the op-ed, Danny Dannon, the senior member of Likud, he put forward his vision the Deputy Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, his vision for resolving the conflict. He said Israel should annex all of the Jewish communities, as he calls them, the illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, all of what he calls the uninhabited areas of the West Bank. And he says, we will let the Palestinians in the main towns of the West Bank have independence, which means Israel will annex 97% of the West Bank, and the Palestinians in the main towns, that is to say 3% of the West Bank, they can have independence. Now, bear in mind, that's the vision of the most moderate element of Netanyahu's coalition. And yet everybody says or tells Hamas what it must do.
You have been listening to a portion of a debate between Professor Norman Finkelstein, presenting the Palestinian narrative, and Daniel Pollack, representing the Zionist Organization of America and the Zionist narrative, as broadcast on the RT television network. Well, I hope this morning's broadcast has not been too confusing. We've tried to provide examples of how the Zionist narrative, the Zionist talking points, which are often factually disingenuous, are being used to justify the occupation and the colonization of the Palestinian homeland, and how the fact-based Palestinian narrative is being used to counter that false narrative. We urge you to read the history, study the maps, and draw your own conclusions as to which narrative is more truthful. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, those coming down the road to confront us, and those talking to our children sooner or later as well. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Well, before jumping into the economic updates for this last week, let's take stock. What a week it was. In fact, what a last few weeks it's been, economically speaking. Let me just mention a few of the big events. Donald Trump, President of the United States, suffered the second major defeat of a major initiative since he's become president. The first one was his attempt to ban Muslims from a variety of countries from coming in to the United States. Two separate courts in the United States have struck that down, and so he was defeated twice. Now he proposed, with the Republican Party, a repeal of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And in the run-up to a climactic vote in the House of Representatives, basically, he was defeated again when a significant number of Republicans, conservative Republicans indicated they would join with Democrats in voting against such a repeal, and so it was never allowed even to get to that point, defeat number two. For a president elected with such promises and with many, many hopeful signs on that part of the political spectrum, these defeats are having major effects. The first one was a sharp downturn in the stock market as investors began to wonder whether bidding up stocks since Mr. Trump's election may have been a big mistake if he can't get through all the glittering promises that made stock investors feel as though it was their time indeed in this world. So that shook the world economy. But it was only one of many. Let me give you a few of the others. The Prime Minister of Great Britain, Mrs. May, sent a letter officially starting the process of separating the United Kingdom from the European Union, of which it has been a part for a long time. This is a major change in the world capitalist system. The two major economies of Europe are Britain and Germany. They kind of dominated. This is a separation of the two largest parts of the European Economic Union and a decision to go their own way. They're now going to negotiate for a couple of years in what promises to be bitter, protracted, with people now observing, wondering whether they'll even reach an agreement and how much of the division will cost the economies both of Great Britain and of the rest of the European continent. It also means that one of the three great capitalist centers of the world, North America, Western Europe, and the Far East, are now going to be reduced to North America and the Far East because the disunion in Europe looks to be pretty severe and terminal. And that further reduces to a global economy that has two poles, the United States at one end and the People's Republic of China at the other. And that will take a long time to play itself out, but is a major change in how the world economy looks and where it's going. But I'm still not done. In France, something is playing itself out, and France, after Germany, is the second most important economy on continental Europe. A drama is playing out that will come to a head in the next few weeks with elections there for the presidency. And here we see again an extreme sort of shakeup of the world economy. The two leading candidates are an extreme right-wing person, Marine Le Pen, who favors an end to France's participation in the European Union, who is an admirer of Donald Trump, who also, and this is very important, is a ferocious anti-immigration candidate who wants to expel from parts of Europe many of the immigrants that have fueled Europe's economic rise over the last few decades, etc. On the other hand, is an ex-socialist. He's come more to the middle. His name is Macron, but he was part of the Socialist Party, the right wing, if you like, of the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party, let's remember, was the second major party in France, which currently governs and sits in the presidential palace. So what's going on? Well, French politics is disintegrating. The leading right-wing candidate, Mr. Fillon, was caught with his hand in the cookie jar, generously giving money, state money, of course, to his wife and children. He got caught. He's in the press all the time. He's done as a politician. So the official right wing, the conventional right wing, the establishment right wing, has nobody. If that sounds familiar in terms of the American election, good, and I'm getting my point across. Mrs. Le Pen is not considered likely to win, but she's a strong candidate, and she's a bit of a Trump-type phenomena. On the other hand, you have
well, roughly something like Mrs. Clinton. A Democrat here, well, in France, that would mean a socialist, a right-wing socialist, very moderate, like Mrs. Clinton, a centrist Democrat. And over on the far left, you actually have two candidates, unfortunately for them, splitting the left-wing vote. Otherwise, they would be a major player here, the old left wing of the Socialist Party and an anti-capitalist party that's an important player in French politics. So you see, the middle is falling apart. The conventional rules of politics and economics don't work. And I think something is going on that is worthy of my attention and of yours. The world capitalist system is in deep trouble. We have not recovered from the crash of 2008. All complaints or claims to that point, I believe, are mistaken, and I'll say more about that as we go on in this program. But at this point, I think the evidence is mounting in the realm of politics that it's not politics as usual because it's not capitalism as usual. Capitalism, at least in North America, Western Europe, Japan, and places like that, has never recovered from the shock of having another great crash after the horrible one in the 1930s, another one now since 2008. The mass of people have not recovered, which is why they are voting in ways they haven't for a long time, producing a Trump, a Le Pen, a Brexit, and on and on and on. We're going to be watching this a great deal, but at this point, I wanted really to underscore that something major is shaking politics. Last little detail. Recent polls have asked the American people, who among the major politicians of our time do you most admire? The answer has been Bernie Sanders. Far and away. Tells you something about American society that a man who calls himself a socialist, who does not run from that label, is the most popular political candidate on the horizon. It is contrasted with the declining popularity of Mr. Trump that has no historical precedent either. All right, well, before jumping into the regular short economic updates that we usually focus on in the first half, I wanted to remind you of something we are very proud of here at Democracy at Work, the organization that produces this program. We've recently been joined with, partnered with, Free Speech TV, which brings this program in a televised form all over the United States to millions of households. We're very proud of that, and for those of you that might be interested, you can see this program in a television form, Sunday evening, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, with the appropriate adjustments for Central Mountain and Pacific Time. And we're just so proud that Free Speech TV was interested enough in what we do to enable us to reach more of you through a televised format. And finally, for those of you who like this program, who appreciate the economic updates we provide, but would like to take a further step to become involved with others who share your perspective to make the very changes that this program shows us we need, please let us know of your interest. Groups are forming that are committed to the kinds of change we talk about, particularly having to do with worker co-ops. And if such a thing interests you, let us know. And the easiest way to do that is to get in touch with us through our two websites, democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And the other one, R.D. Wolf, that's me, R.D. Wolf with two Fs, .com. Both of those websites are available to you 24/7, no charge whatsoever, and they allow you to communicate with us if you're interested in such groups, or indeed to communicate anything you would like to do or have us do, to follow us by a click on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and in general to take advantage of all that we put on those websites. All right, all preliminaries taken care of. Let's jump in to the updates. Again, I want to stress These are signs of changing times. So let's begin with a bizarre letter sent by a number of the wealthiest people on this planet who reside in the state of New York to the current governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. Some of these people include George Soros, a multi-billionaire, Stephen Rockefeller, of a family whose name needs no further comment, and Abigail Disney, yes, of that Disney family. They wrote a letter together with a whole bunch of other people asking the governor of New York to please raise their taxes by a lot. It might raise as much as $2 billion by taxing top income earners, people earning over $650,000 a year, just them. So let's be clear. The richest, some of them, are asking Governor Cuomo to tax them more heavily than he currently does, and that the legislature of New York likewise doesn't tax them. Wow. What's their argument? Their argument is that education, highways and bridges, indeed everything that the state does for people is in trouble, is being cut, is not being adequately maintained. They're fearful that the society that ultimately they too depend on is falling apart. And since they are billionaires and earn wild amounts of money, a tax on them will not hurt or impinge their lifestyles, not in the slightest, but could help maintain a society that they too depend on. It's a sign of the times, not only that wealthy people are able to see that and are willing to pony up something for it, but even more important is the fact that they are a small minority, that the bulk of people who earn big bucks like they do have no interest in, have no support for, and are utterly absent from this initiative. That may help us to understand why a similar letter sent last year by many of the same people got nowhere. And my prediction, and that of most of those who observe the governor and the legislature in New York, is this year's letter will get exactly the same response as last year's. But it is a sign of the times. Here's another one. This one might be called the distance between reality and political fiction. Tuesday of last week, of this last week, President Ford tweeted his pleasure at hearing that President Trump tweeted his pleasure at hearing that the Ford Motor Company was investing $1.2 billion in Michigan to build some facilities. Jobs, 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 President Trump tweeted. Well, it led me to look into it. What was Ford doing, and how many jobs were we actually talking about here? $1.2 billion is a lot of money, could be a lot of jobs. Well, I won't bore you with the details, but here is what the Ford Motor Company said would be the result of the $1.2 billion it's investing in Michigan. And I'm going to quote you because this is so clear and so important that I want to get the words right. This investment will either, here we go, retain or create 130 jobs. Yes, you heard me right. Retain means keeping a job you already have there. Create is when you have a new job. This $1.2 billion will retain or create 130 jobs. That's the reality. The rest is political hype. And that has been the same story of everything else. Mr. Trump does not have the power or is unwilling to try to use the power he has to really force matters in terms of jobs. So he has retreated more and more to manufacturing out of nothing the jobs that his administration promised, but can't, in fact, compel the corporations to deliver. Okay, here's another example of a shift in America. A week or two ago, the city of Seattle in Washington, the city council of Seattle, voted unanimously to create a 15-member board, which will begin meeting this summer, to talk about pushing laws that will help renters in Seattle. Yes, a renter's commission, which will not have on it homeowners, it will not have on it landlords. That's right. It's an attempt to give some official clout to renters, a part of our economy that is huge. In many cities, more than half the people who live there are renters. In virtually all cities, renters are a very significant part of the population. But typically, their voices are barely heard by the mayor, by the city council, by the politicians. And the reasons for that are not hard to find. Renters are the lowest income. If you have more income, you tend to buy your own home. And if you're really well off, you can buy a home that you rent to others. That makes you a landlord. Those folks, the homeowners, have ways of getting together and putting pressure on City Hall. The landlords are even better at that. They have the most money, they pool that money, they create lobbyists and pressure groups, they pay for advertising. In short, the laws all over the United States favor landlords and secondarily homeowners at the expense of renters. Of course, occasionally renters can mobilize, but it takes a lot of work by people who have full-time jobs and very little extra money, which is why, even when they're successful, it doesn't last, given the overwhelming preponderance of wealthy pressure coming from homeowners and from landlords. So they've taken an interesting tack in Seattle. You're beginning to see this kind of fighting back against long-standing injustices. And in the case of Seattle, there's now going to be a commission fought, by the way. The landlords fought it, then they demanded to have seats on it. They failed. They couldn't prevent it, and they couldn't get any seats on it. So you're going to see for the first time that the pressures and organizations and lobbies of the landlords have to deal with another expression, an organized, mobilized expression of renters' interests, and it's going to change the city of Seattle, which was discovering that because of high-income people wanting to live in Seattle, because of new uses for apartments such as Airbnb, which take over apartments that might otherwise have been rented out to people who are permanent residents, etc., that rents have been going up and that the unaffordability of rental housing is hurting large numbers of people. And they are going to do something about it, and the renters now have a focus for their concerns. Very interesting development. Very few cities in the United States have anything like that, and it's my hope that by making it clear to you that this is an important breakthrough, that other cities may begin to see the need for doing that. Next item. The Secretary, and I won't make much comment because none is really necessary. The new Secretary of Education in the United States, Mrs. DeVos, has made a new ruling, and I want you all to know, and particularly those of you who may be students, or those of you who may be parents, friends, and so forth, of students. Under her new rule, designed, as she said, to help make America great again, she now will allow what the Obama administration had disallowed. She will allow a penalty to be assessed on students who default on their college loans. This penalty in the past could not be assessed if the student found a way to make up the payment within 2 months of defaulting. Mrs. DeVos has decided not to allow 2 months. In other words, to enable the lender, the bank or the lender who provides money for a student loan, to assess a penalty equal up to 16% of the outstanding loan on a student who defaults, even if that student can make the payment within 2 months of defaulting. No two-month allowance. This in an age of growing difficulty for students is a contribution, clearly, to making America great again, so that the bankers and the lenders can hit the students up for 16% for defaulting and not paying it back, even if it's paid back within 2 months. As I said, no further comment from me is needed. All right, last one that we may have some time for. The topic I haven't talked about much on this program, but I want to address now. There is a case coming up to the Supreme Court. It's called Villarreal versus R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. Villarreal is the name of a person who worked for, his name is Richard Villarreal, who worked for many years for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. He applied for a job, a better job, sales job online, and was refused. He applied actually several times and was refused, according to the news reports. And he didn't think much of it until there was a whistleblower, a person inside R.J. Reynolds, who announced that they were discriminating against people who were older than a certain age, and that Mr. Villarreal began to believe that he might have been a victim of that, which it turns out he feels he was. It is illegal in the United States to practice age discrimination. It has been for decades. You are not allowed by law to deny a person an opportunity or a job on grounds of his or her age. You can decide it on grounds of their capability, their competence, their performance, but not their age. No age discrimination. But here clearly was an example in the minds of Richard Villarreal, and so he went to court. And it's going all the way to the Supreme Court. The defense of R.J. Reynolds is remarkable. Their defense is that he didn't pursue the denial of a job from his online application, so he didn't really suffer. He didn't really care about this until someone announced that R.J. Reynolds was doing something they shouldn't do. I'm no lawyer, but sounds like a strange defense that doesn't get at the issue. And their other defense was that this law should only apply to people already working. And it turns out, when I checked my statistics and my information, that Mr. Villarreal wasn't already working. He was just applying for a sales position with R.J. Reynolds. And since he was only applying, but not yet already working, well, then apparently R.J. Reynolds thinks age discrimination is okay. This is worrisome because it deals with the letter of the details, not with the spirit of the law. They are discriminating on the grounds of age. How many Americans are discriminated against when there isn't a whistleblower and no one catches them? We will not know. Very last item, and then I have to stop for the short updates of this time. Latest information from Bloomberg is that we're coming on to a crisis of subprime loans. But this time it isn't subprime loans to homeowners. That's what crashed the economy in 2008. No, the latest statistics indicate that we are now heading right into a subprime auto loan crisis. Turns out the boom in automobiles in recent years was overwhelmingly fueled by loans, and an increasing portion of loans to people with bad credit histories who are not able to pay. To give you an example of what is going on, these people are now unable to maintain their payments. Their cars are being taken away from them. The impact on their lives is catastrophic. The market in selling off used cars is collapsing. It is making people who depend on selling used cars, for example, the Hertz Rent-A-Car Corporation has its stock in the floor because it depends on selling those rental cars into a market now where they can't get the prices they expected. The damage is beginning to mount, and it does leave you with a sense very little was learned by our great banking community in the last crash, and they're busy gearing up for the next one. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update for this week. Once again, I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I'm a professor of economics. I've been that all my life. And it is a pleasure for me to bring these programs to you every week. And in this second half, I'm going to be devoting myself to some major conversations, some major discussions of really big issues that affect us now. It's a little different from the first half, where we do short, punchier kinds of updates of recent events. Let me start with immigration. It's an enormous issue. It was in the election campaign here in the United States. It continues to be, and it will no doubt flare up in the months and years ahead. And it is likewise an enormous, important issue in England, having to do with the leaving of England from the European Union. It is the major issue in recent elections in Holland, in elections in the next couple of weeks in France, and so on. I want to deal with the economics of immigration in a particular way. Opponents of immigration have argued that immigrants draw on the public services, say here in the United States, of all kinds, without making a contribution to pay for them. In other words, they are beneficiaries of public services of all kinds, but do not help to pay for them, and therefore are a burden on the rest of the population. It's a parallel argument you'll often hear to the notion that immigrants are people who displace native citizens from jobs and are therefore a burden in terms of job availability for folks who are not immigrants. I want to focus on the first of those two. I want to talk about immigrants drawing on public services versus contributing to pay for them. I do that not as an advocate for or against immigration. That's not my issue here. But if we're going to have a conversation about immigration and the economics of it, which these two big arguments against immigration are, economic arguments, well, then it is necessary, just in the interest of simple fairness and truth, to talk about both sides of the ledger. How do immigrants, in fact, help pay for public services, which I will show you now, they do, and quite generously. So let's begin. The most important tax for most people is not what you might think. It's not the income tax, the money held out of your weekly check. There are immigrants who have that withheld, just like everybody else, and pay that tax. There are undocumented immigrants who work under the table, who don't have that money withheld, and often it means that they're not even paid what they're supposed to because the employer can get away with it. They're undocumented. They're insecure. They can't really go to the police or anywhere else to complain about being ill-paid, unpaid, because they are in a dangerous place, not having the documents they need. But that, too, is not my major concern. Most people pay most of their taxes not in the form of an income tax, but in the form of other kinds of taxes. And their immigrants, whether they're documented or not, pay and pay a lot. Let me give you just a few examples. Sales taxes, that little addition when you buy something in a clothing store or a department store or virtually anywhere, depending on where you live, sales taxes apply to most, if not all, objects that you buy in a store. The immigrant pays that tax just as well as everybody else. Otherwise, the immigrant doesn't get the article, whether it's a piece of clothing or a piece of equipment or whatever it is. So immigrants are paying loads of money in sales taxes. You might have understood that, but let's continue. Immigrants also pay excise taxes. The federal government puts a very hefty excise tax on things like cigarette products, gasoline, motor oil and gasoline, and alcoholic beverages. Immigrants who smoke or drink or drive anywhere and buy gas are paying excise taxes to Uncle Sam all the time. But here comes the even bigger ones. Everyone who studies immigration knows what the pattern is, because it's been the pattern in the United States for 100 or more years. We have, in all American cities, or almost all of them, neighborhoods that we all recognize are in bad shape, are suffering, have poorly maintained housing, poorly maintained streets. You know the pattern. You can call them downtrodden, you can call them slums. It doesn't really matter. They are neighborhoods filled with residential housing, sometimes big apartment buildings, sometimes low. But this is housing where there aren't enough people to live there. They're dilapidated for that reason. The landlords don't maintain those buildings very well, in part because they don't have tenants for the apartments. Either there aren't the folks there to do it, or the folks who might want to live there don't have the money to do it. These neighborhoods deteriorate. And when they deteriorate, the following always happens. Landlords begin to miss their tax payments. They don't pay taxes on these buildings and on the land that these buildings sit on because they're not earning income, because they don't have tenants able and willing to live and pay rent there. Keep that now in your mind. In comes a wave of immigration. Let's say in the last 30 years or so, a wave of immigration mostly from Central and Southern America, our neighbors to the south. The people who come here are not all, but overwhelmingly poor. They are running away from political conflict, from war, and from economic distress, poverty. They arrive at an American city with very little more than the clothes on their back and whatever they can carry in a dilapidated suitcase. Where do they go? Well, we all know, and you know too. They go and look for jobs. And the jobs they get are the bottom of the pile. They work in the car wash. They work at the back of the restaurant. They work in the hospital doing the most menial work. They do the work in the fields, picking the crop. You all know, just like I do, just like all Americans do. And here's what else we all know. They crowd together because they don't have much money. And you know where they crowd together? In the poorest, most run-down areas of the city, where the rents are the lowest because the houses have been neglected and the landlords haven't kept them up. You get the picture? But now here comes the economics lesson. It's precisely because the immigrants do that, crowd too many people in so they can pool the little bit of money each of them earns to pay the landlord to have a roof over their head. And it's because immigrants come and fill those dilapidated buildings in that poor part of town that the landlords begin to have the rental income that enables them to pay taxes. That's right. The biggest expense of most immigrants is housing. And a big portion of the money they pay for housing is simply enabling the landlord to whom they pay that money to pay his taxes. A landlord will tell you, the rents I charge are needed by me to cover the cost of the housing that includes the taxes I have to pay. Well, then let's give credit where credit is due. The occupation of sometimes huge portions of cities by immigrants paying rent enables those landlords to pay their taxes. And if the city doesn't get that money from those landlords who get it from those immigrants, then the city can't maintain the public schools, the city can't maintain the roads, the public parks, help at the hospital. You get the picture. We all benefit who live in American cities from the enormous contribution made by large populations of immigrants in maintaining rental income and thereby the tax portion of rental income. The next time you think about expelling immigrants, try to think about this problem. Here's where you might have thought about it in the last 3 years. Over the last few years, the Obama administration deported many such immigrants, millions of them. They therefore lost their apartments. They stopped paying rent because they weren't in the country anymore. Landlords now suffered emptying out buildings. They couldn't collect rents from immigrants that the Obama administration had deported. And so those landlords stopped paying their taxes. Many of them abandoned the buildings, which then deteriorated in ways they would not have otherwise, destroying those neighborhoods, becoming fire hazards, you name it. We all suffered because of the economic consequences of expelling immigrants. If you want to weigh the costs and benefits of immigration, the very least you have to do, if you're honestly engaged in the subject, is weigh the costs, and there are costs, against the benefits, and there are plenty of those. Otherwise, you're not having a conversation, and you're not fairly assessing a situation. What you're doing is making immigrants a scapegoat for other social problems, which is what my opinion is, what we see going on. We have an economy that isn't working well for the majority of American people. And rather than have us as a nation face that fact, talk about an economic system that makes billionaires out of the few, even the few that want to pay more taxes are not allowed to do it, that damages the middle and really hurts the mass of the poor. But instead of talking about a system that works like that, which is what we should be doing, we scapegoat immigrants. as if kicking out another 2 or 3 million is going to make a big difference. Kicking out the last 2 or 3 million wrecked their lives. It did not solve the economic problems of the United States, nor will doing more of it have any better effect. And one of the reasons is all of the economic costs we pay if we don't have these waves of immigration that has sustained the United States for most of its history. We reverse all of that. There is a heavy economic price to pay. Whatever the gains in fewer people using public services, there are losses in having fewer people contribute. The sales taxes, the excise taxes, the rental payments that pay the property taxes that landlords have, these are things that have to be faced if you're serious about the issue. Next, we talk often on this program, and I'm going to do it again, about worker co-ops as an alternative to the typical capitalist corporation. Once again, just to remind everyone, the typical capitalist corporation has a tiny group of people who make all the decisions. Those people are called major shareholders, the people who own the shares of any sizable company, or if it isn't that kind of a company, the family or whoever who are the owners. And the owners, whether they're shareholders or some family, choose the top directors of the company. In a corporation, it's called the board of directors. The way that works in the United States and in most other countries is the following. Once a year, the shareholders elect the board of directors. Board of directors typically have 12 to 20 people who sit on them, and they have to be elected. And the way it works is you get a vote according to how many shares of the company you were rich enough to buy. So if you own no shares, you get no votes. The majority of workers in most factories don't have any shares. They therefore have no votes. If a worker in a factory has some shares, they're a handful. The big blocks of shares are owned by the wealthy in the United States. So you might like to know that 1% of shareholders own about 2/3 of the shares. There's your 1%. So the 1% who have, like, say, 1 million shares each get 1 million votes. You, who's your grandmother left you 11 shares, you get 11 votes. You get the picture. So the board of directors responds to and is chosen by the major shareholders. That's it. Major shareholders, a dozen folks. Board of directors, another dozen folks. You got 25, 30 people. They make all the key decisions. They decide what the company produces, where the company produces, how, what technology the company uses, and what's done with the profits. Everybody works there. All the employees, who could be 1,000, could be 10,000, could be 100,000. But it's a tiny group of people who make all the key decisions, including what's done with the profits that all the workers help to produce. A worker co-op is different. It's a democratically organized enterprise. What does that mean? It's very simple. All the workers in an enterprise, whatever they do, one person, one vote. They decide together what the company will produce, where it will produce, what technology it will use, and how to use the profits that they all helped to produce. It's a democratic enterprise, something which a capitalist enterprise never has been and is not today. And however difficult that may be to face, it is the only reality we have, and to not face it isn't a smart move either. So let's continue. Last time I talked about issues that arise in distributing profits, how a worker co-op would, of course, never distribute its profits the way a capitalist corporation does. Just to remind you, capitalist corporations distribute the bulk of their profits, what's left over after they manage the business, to themselves, which should come as no surprise to you. They give their top managers wild salaries, much, much higher than what average workers get, and they pay out a huge portion of their profits, typically, to their shareholders. Not surprisingly, since the shareholders and the top execs are the decision makers, and they give it to themselves. Obviously, in a worker co-op, wouldn't work like that because you have a democratic decision. The profits would be much more, here we go, equally distributed. Not the same amount to each person, but nothing like the inequality that makes a few executives have more money than they know what to do with and the mass of people worrying about how to pay the basic bills of a week's life. But I want to go on to other examples. I want to use the example of location. You might think it's simple, but it isn't. Where do we produce something? A software program, a piece of machinery, a product of cleaning things. It doesn't really matter where. Over the last 40 years, a growing number of capitalist enterprises have made the decision to move production from locations in the United States to locations elsewhere, and in particular to locations in Asia, but all over the world. A variety of factors led them to make these decisions, but by far the most important one was wages. They could get the work done in China or India or Brazil or wherever by paying much less per hour to a worker than they had to pay here in the United States. They saw more profit, and so they made the decision. Why? Because it was good for them to do it. It made more profits. It got the work done, producing whatever they were producing, by paying workers a much lower amount of money. So when they sold the product, they had to give less of the revenue they got from selling the product to the workers, because the workers got lower wages. That left more for them, higher profits. No-brainer, very simple. That's why it's been going on. That's why so many factories are empty. That's why so many towns are in trouble, because the jobs they once saw have moved to Mexico, to wherever. All right, now let's go to a worker co-op. Worker co-op is informed, hey, we could close this factory and move somewhere else. But you don't need me to tell you that's not going to happen, is it? It's not going to happen because the workers in a place, if they had a democratic decision, would never destroy their own jobs, would never deprive the community where they live of the tax revenue from a business in that community, which pays for the schools and the parks and all the rest of what they enjoy as part of their lives. No, no. The workers, if they made the decision, would keep the business here. Well, you say, oh, how could they then compete with other companies from other parts of the world? Well, actually, there's lots of answers to that question. They could compete by passing laws that give them an advantage, that make it difficult for other people to ship cheap stuff here if it is made by exploiting workers at very low wages. Might be an interesting argument, has been used in the past. There are other ways to accommodate also. You can be more efficient in a variety of ways that a worker co-op can do. A worker co-op typically has people who are very interested in managing their own affairs. They don't like supervisors that much. They don't need multiple layers of administrators, and they don't want them. Workers will take care of the business themselves if it's their business and if it's in their interest to do so, and they won't need a lot of supervision. And the money saved on supervision gives a worker co-op a competitive advantage over a capitalist who needs many layers of supervision because the workers know that they're working for him and not for themselves. Turns out worker co-ops have no problem competing against capitalist enterprises. So it is viable. And you know something else? Worker co-ops might also have the following idea. I'm going to use the clothing industry as an example. When the manufacturers, the capitalists who made clothing here in the United States, decided to shut down the mills here, to shut down the textile factories and the clothing factories, and open them up in China and Bangladesh and Mexico and Haiti and wherever they went, once again, they did it to save money and to make more profits. but it had a side effect that workers in a worker co-op might be concerned about. If you produce clothing in China, as much of it is, it means you have to ship the clothing 10,000 miles across the ocean in freighters. Those freighters pollute the ocean, and they pollute the air. The pollution is not a problem for the capitalists because no one charges them for that. They make their profits because their wages are so low in those parts of the world they can pay the freight to ship the stuff back. But we, the people, the mass of people organized in worker co-ops, we live with the polluted ocean that can't sustain the fish population. We live with the polluted air and all that it does to our climate. Worker co-ops wouldn't allow that to happen, and we wouldn't have that pollution, would we? When you put it all together, it turns out that if worker co-ops had made the decision in the last 40 years, we wouldn't be looking at the decimated landscape that we have. We wouldn't be looking at the level of pollution that threatens us. We would have had different decisions about our economy and our ecology and much else. Let me use another example that talks about this ecology. You know, a capitalist company hears about a new machine. It pollutes the air, pollutes the water. It's terrible. But the executives of the company say it increases our profits. What do we care that it destroys the environment? It's not our problem. We have to make more money because otherwise we won't succeed. That's what we're paid for. We're the executives. We make the decisions. Besides which, we live in a gated community 40 miles from the factory. We don't have to breathe that air there. We don't have to worry about the water. We have filtered water in our bathrooms. So they make the decision to use a bad technology. And they say to their workers, you know, you're free to leave. You don't like to breathe this air. Go someplace else. Not my problem. Now, suppose a worker co-op had to make the same decision. They heard about a new machine, and the new machine makes it more profitable to do the business. They'd be interested in that being more profitable. But they would also have to weigh what? The pollution of the air and the water, because it's the pollution they will live with, that their husband or wife will live with, that their children will live with, that their relatives and neighbors and friends and their community. And they're going to weigh that in a way that a capitalist board of directors never would. Never did. Guess what? Having worker co-ops gives you a much more solid basis for making practical decisions in a business that will not cause environmental damage compared to what you get with a capitalistically organized enterprise. See, it turns out that worker co-ops have all kinds of advantages relative to capitalistically organized enterprises, which is a fundamental reason why, if you think about it, an economy like ours ought to give people at least the choice. Let's have a large worker co-op sector of the American economy. Everywhere in America, there should be, let's say, competing capitalist and worker co-op enterprises. You already have that in Spain in a big way. You already have it in Italy in a big way. So we have plenty of models to use. No problem. This is not new. This is old. It's only new in America where we're waking up to catching up with what others have understood. If we had a worker co-op sector, we could see about the environmental impact of that kind of enterprise versus the capitalist. We could see about losing jobs in one system versus another. Americans would actually have, for the first time, freedom of choice. Choose to buy from a capitalist versus a worker co-op enterprise. Choose to work in a top-down hierarchical capitalist enterprise or a democratic worker enterprise. That choice we don't have. We could, but we don't have it. Think about it, folks, because as the capitalist economy is having the kinds of troubles we talked about at the beginning of this program, looking for alternatives for which the worker co-op is the number one contender right now, is more important than ever.
Thank you so much for spending your time with me. This is Richard Wolff for Economic Update. I want to thank all of you that are partners with us, that tell others about this program, that share what you've learned here with others. That's why we do it. I want to thank our longtime partner, truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis you can check out on the internet anytime. Stay with us in the weeks to come. I look forward with talking with you again.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Desiree McFlain, in studio with Dr. Nolan Higdon and Dr. Nicholas Bam III. Mickey and Peter will return next week. On today's program, we will discuss what you can do to stop our slide into post-truth America. We'll be joined by Dr. Allison Butler of University of Massachusetts, who will explain what citizens and educators can do to be media literate in the age of Trump. We will also be joined by Dr. Bill Usman of Sacred Heart University's Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program, who tells us about the importance of critical media literacy in the age of Trump. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. We'll be joined later by our intern and special announcer, Alicia Lajardo. All right, so the news cycle has been dominated over the last few months with this issue of privacy. And it's interesting to me how, on the one hand, you have like this strong sort of grassroots conservative libertarian movement who talks about privacy, protecting like the white working class in the age of Trump. But there's all these signs from Snowden and the Vault 7, the WikiLeaks document, that privacy of everyone is being compromised. And I bring this up because there seems to be this lack of awareness amongst many individuals, and this may just be the millennial generation. I don't know if that's true or not, but that they don't realize how important privacy is to a lot of these social justice movements. For example, working class unions had to deal with spies and having blacklists of people who wanted to unionize. African-American slaves battled slave catchers, slave passes, slaves being loyal to their masters, not being able to hold meetings together without a white person being there in many cases. Latinos in the Southwest, this invasion of privacy about, you know, they had to prove their citizenship, prove they were not undocumented. Chinese Americans during the Chinese Exclusion Acts, obviously Japanese Americans during the internment camps, women trying to find safe space in these homes that acted like prisons. Americans seem like totally unaware that privacy has been a critical part of trying to protect people, and taking away privacy has been a tool of people to create oppression. And I would argue, you know, it's been more compromised than I think Orwell even imagined, right? Orwell had like the screen in the house. I think the critical difference is now people are buying tools and putting them in their home. So it's not like Big Brother's forcing you. The stuff's being put in your home. And just so, you know, for our listeners, WikiLeaks released a series of leaks from the Central Intelligence Agency. It's the CIA. You might know them from overthrowing democratic regimes, assassinating people, and to try and destroy peace movements, or as Trump calls it, freedom. And the CIA is the largest publication ever of confidential documents by the agency. And the documents show how the CIA has been stealing data from Apple products by tapping into people's iPhones and iPad and Google Android phones. And The CIA has a menu of hacking tools for its assets to use, as well as fingerprints or other tools stolen from other states. So they have basically this big menu of methods. Now, where Snowden kind of showed the data they were collecting, these leaks actually show how they're collecting it. So naturally, the corporate media says that, look, the issue is about who leaked it, who leaked it. Wrong. The issue is about what is being done to citizens, right? We always get on to who leaked it and how it got out there and whether or not it should be out there. We rarely sort of address the impact it's having on these people. And so I watched the corporate media go through these series of just discussions of who leaked it rather than actually look at what the leaks mean. And, I mean, we saw some documentaries, too, that addressed this. I mean, you were talking about Do Not Resist some time ago, weren't you?
Yes. That's a really good one, and especially towards the end of it, they introduced a gentleman named Richard Burke, and he was the one who really got into forecasting potential threats and stuff like that, and basically criminalizing youth before they're even born in the womb and forecasting their possibility and 50-50 chance of being homicidal and stuff like that. And it's ridiculous that we're forecasting that far in advance or at all.
Yeah, I remember that in the documentary, one of the guys in there says, like, what if you told a mother that the child in the womb has a 50-50 chance of being a criminal? I'm not sure what she would decide. I'm just like, what are you even talking about? Like,
yeah.
Where do you get that? Like, someone who can't hold children. But it brings this question. I mean, you had, like, John Oliver claiming that there's no proof that they went after U.S. citizens. Newsweek argued that the leak is actually in support of Russia. And NPR decided that, or defended the CIA, arguing the CIA only targets certain people or the NSA did it in bulk. And I think it draws from this larger problem where I believe a lot of Americans think, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, what does it matter? What I like to tell, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I think that oftentimes there are things we do that are not wrong or illegal that can be used against us. You know, I think of people like Anthony Weiner, for example, who's going after like issues of poverty and universal health care. And then all of a sudden, like his mobile pictures of him naked pop up. And that's enough to like take away his regime. And what he was doing in Congress wasn't illegal. And I mean, things he did to his wife, I'm going to argue my prayer were immoral. But nonetheless, it's used as this thing against him, right? So it's collecting this large swath of data you can use to destroy someone's character, even if they're not doing something illegal.
I agree. I mean, Anthony Weiner, at worst, is an exhibitionist. Now, to the degree that he's exhibiting himself in front of someone who's underage, I think that that's a problem. But outside of that, does Anthony Weiner's exhibitionism take away from his political savvy and his political contributions? I'm not sure that it does. It's his particular sexual practice, and I think, frankly, if we're respecting the rights of privacy, as long as he's worked this out with his wife, that's their business. It's not our business.
I just don't think that people know the extent of how much of their lives. I mean, especially, I'm 33 now, but even people younger than me, they have their whole lives of data in the social media that can be used against them at any time. You know, it's a generation, I would say, is really vulnerable to this. We know they have these things in the home like Echo and the television recording, the car recordings, the phone recordings, the laptop camera recordings. It's a massive amount of data you have on an individual to destroy them.
It is interesting that in a free society, you have to think about these things. I know that from myself being a little bit older, I've often thought, well, hey, if I ran for office, does that In These Times subscription that I had back in college and the one that I've renewed recently, does that work against me in some way? Does it work against me that when I was studying political science at the University of Chicago that I took about 3 or 4 courses in Marxism, aside from what I do on social media? Right.
Yeah.
And then how do you balance that with the other stuff you do on social media? When I look at my own social media profile, I see a very contradictory picture of just a total human being. I do a lot of stuff. Some of it, I think, would be very consistent with what you'd want in somebody who would run in politics. And some of it, not so much. But I also worry about things like I have dreadlocks. You know, and we found out that the courts have supported that in private industry, they can ask you to cut your dreadlock. How does that play out in the political world, right, or in other public spaces? What is there that they can decide to hold against you? And I think that the lens will continually shift on that.
It's interesting, especially with social media, because in the regular context of life, we go through changes, we have crazy hair and crazy things, you know, and we grow out of that. But when you've posted all that on MySpace years ago, and now it's on Instagram and on Facebook, it's there and you can't get rid of it. Even when these sites go down like MySpace, you can still Google and your pictures still pop up and you have no control over that. So like you said, that completely is a detriment to any future you know, definitely political, anything political that you're going to do in the future, that definitely tampers that. But on the other end, with things like Instagram and Snapchat, it's interesting because I've heard a comment along the lines of us as millennials building our own FBI files and giving all the data that they would ever need to accumulate on us ourselves. Like, we just give it out for free. We're taking pictures, selfies and stuff, facial, you know, recognized technology or whatever you call it, facial recognition. Like, we've supplied them with anything that they would ever possibly need just on our own. So, and we don't think of that at all.
Well, I encourage our listeners, yeah, check out WikiLeaks, Vault 7 leaks, check out the Snowden leaks, and be familiar of how your information might be compromised. I think we should plug Do Not Resist as well, which I think was a great documentary, since the corporate media will not do its job. Let's flip it over to headlines with Alicia.
Hello, everyone. I am Alicia Guajardo with the Media Freedom Foundation. Here are just some of the stories we are working on. Dr. Elliot Cohen published Warrantless Spying, Russian Targets, and Trumped Up Wiretap Charges, What the Feds Might Really Have on the President. At ProjectCensored.org, Cohen lays out a legal argument for why wiretapping Trump and the Russia-Trump connection are dominating the corporate media news cycle. You can find that at ProjectCensored.org. Also at ProjectCensored.org, former Project Censored director Dr. Peter Phillips published The Diabolical Business of Global Public Relations Firms. It is another article in his continuing series about media, propaganda, and the transnational corporate class. In this article, Phillips documents the collusion between PR firms and the news media. That can be found at ProjectCensored.org. It's worth noting that we heard positive feedback about the student proposals we discussed last week. The proposals came from Nolan Higdon's students at California State University East Bay. They introduced problems and offered proposals for solutions the students hope to enact. They can be found at gcml.org. And if you would like to give us feedback here at the Project Censored Show, go ahead and email Nolan at nolanhigdonprojectcensored@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. I'm Alicia Guajardo, and that is the news that did not make the news.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will return after this musical break.
Back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain, and Nicholas Baham III. So I keep hearing this idea that Trump is not normal, and the era of Trump is not normal, and I've seen this hashtag, not normal. And I saw Dan Rather wondering out loud if the Trump administration is nothing more than a reality show. He said, this is not normal. And Nick, I thought you had an interesting take on this big quest to say that Trump is not normal.
I certainly think that I want to critique the normalization of Trump, which I think means one thing, and the notion that Trump is normal. So maybe the best word to use is consistent. So I don't think that there's a whole lot different in terms of the corruption we're already seeing in the Trump administration that differs from, say, the relationship that Dick Cheney had with Halliburton and the continuation of wars for profit, Watergate for that matter, the Teapot Dome scandal. Many people have forgotten the Teapot Dome scandal. This was a bribery incident that happened in the United States from 1921 to 1922, where Warren G. Harding's Secretary of the Interior, Albert Bacon Fall, leased Navy petroleum reserves at Teapot Dome in Wyoming. and two other locations in California to private oil companies at low rates without competitive bidding. Now, Fall was actually convicted of accepting bribes from the oil companies, although there wasn't anybody ever convicted of paying those bribes. This was the biggest scandal in American politics before Watergate. I also think that we need to think about things like, frankly, Chinese Exclusion Act. How different is that than the Muslim ban that we've got going on right now? Chinese Exclusion Act, which annually let in 105 Chinese into the country. Or, frankly, you know, we need to think about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the renewal of that in terms of an extension of the Homestead Act, which stole so much land from people of American Indian descent and, frankly, really ended somewhere in the 1980s. The last leases were given out on the Homestead Act. A lot of people like to think that that was way, way in the American past. We could even go back to our founding fathers who were doing business with the British, and their whole pivot was, hey, how can we seem to be sort of pro this new independent country and remove ourselves from those British ties? This is totally consistent with what I think we're seeing right now in terms of Trump's affiliations with Russian oligarchs and criminals. We've known that Trump has been mobbed up for a long time. There's a lot of photographs of him with his casinos involved with mob figures. We've known that he's been involved in Russia for a long time. It should be no surprise that Rex Tillerson is coming here in here as Secretary of State and is probably going to walk out of this benefiting his oil company and get back into big oil. How is this different from anything else that we've ever had in American history? In fact, I'll just say this one last thing. There is a way of looking at American history, and I think this is certainly done by Howard Zinn, as a series of continual acts of theft and criminality.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth there. I was going to say that history being so critical. I think for so many years, the field of history, definitely prior to the 1960s, try to do what Hollywood does, which is add a happy bow on the story. And so, you know, I think we really push that a lot in K-12 classrooms. And that's why you have individuals who have this, like, happy picture of U.S. history. And so they want Trump to be abnormal. But really, I mean, I was, and it's funny you brought up Teapot Dome. I always tell my students, I think we're in a 21st century version of the 1920s. Like,
right.
We've come back. But, yeah, there doesn't seem to be this willingness to kind of reflect on what the society actually is or was. It, you know, those problems are the problems in the past, and this is not normal that we're back there. But to your point, I think it's a continuation. These things are never solved. There is no happy ending, unfortunately. We don't have the Hollywood credits rolling in this society.
One thing that I just thought to myself once I realized that Trump really was going to be our president was just me being in the comfort of the fact that I like my racist overt versus covert. And so you have individuals who are totally in line with Trump and totally believe in everything that he's saying, but you would never know. They're probably your professor, they could be your doctor, and you would really never know. That's way more frightening to me than somebody who is outright blatantly in my face telling me how they feel, because then I can determine the threat. So like Nolan said, with the happy bow that we want to put on everything and pretending like he's a revolutionary who was just thinking of these things and just speaking about people the way that he's speaking, when no, this is what America has been known about. You know, this is what America was founded on, the founding fathers and all such. So really, it's just like we need to step into reality, and not reality TV in a sense, like reality. This is our president. He feels this way, whether you believe it or not, or whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the we sort of learned since the 1960s by shaming overt racist people that we said, don't use overt racist terms. So now we've sort of like trained a generation or two of how to be racist without overt racist terms, you know, rather than address racism and how it's in all of us and how it rises to the surface and in which ways it rises to the surface. Instead, there's sort of this pretending game, right? Well, racism dead. I don't say anything overtly racist, so it's gone, right?
Or the redefining of it, kind of like what we were speaking about earlier. But I would much rather you call me poor than low income, in my opinion, because then I know that you're talking about me. So
I think there's a lot of merit to that. To, in other words, the sheets being off, right? Mm-hmm. So now we can see who's underneath those sheets and maybe can more openly critique their connections. I think one of the things I'm really interested in is opening up an investigation of the degree to which the Ku Klux Klan has been involved in our police forces
right.
across the country. If we can get to that analysis, by the way, part of that analysis was always present in the Black Panther Party movement. If we can get to that analysis, maybe we can really get to the root of the things that Black Lives Matter has been dealing with. Is this about the infiltration of the Klan in the police and, frankly, also in local community politics?
That type of research, again, I would say something that shatters our, like, American historical myth, right? The KKK is like that thing from the Civil War that went away. By the way, the KKK has a Twitter account, which I find shocking. But yeah, it shatters the sort of myth that the KKK is still around, still operating, and that the police forces are compromised. I don't remember a time in human history I can point to when police weren't up to some form of criticism until at least the last, like, 30, 40 years. I'm not saying that criticism did anything to solve these problems, but at least, you know, criticism was founded at some level. Now, like, any criticism of police is seen as, like, you know, you're going up there and, like, nailing them to a cross or something just for questioning their motives or questioning their training.
There's a history of particular Black activists actually engaging with the Klan. The Nation of Islam attempted to do this. And I know that the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party under Fred Hampton attempted to do this to a degree, although he was really embracing the white working class. I went to graduate school at Indiana University Bloomington, which was 20 minutes away from the home of the Klan in southern Indiana. They were in our university library. I actually had an engagement with some open Klan members. They were interested in engaging me and a couple of my cohort members in a discussion about Malcolm X. They were researching Malcolm because the film had come out, Spike Lee's film had come out, and they were very curious about the shift of the name Malcolm Little to Malcolm X. So, you know, they study us. And I think one of the things that activists of color have learned is we got to study them.
Absolutely.
And we got to really know what they're doing, where they're coming from, what the ideology is all about.
And that they're here and that they exist. And they're not just in Mississippi and Indiana. They're here in California, in New York, you know, all over. So
out of curiosity, Nick, that moment you talk about, that was on campus, correct?
That was on campus in the library. And because it's a state university, you can come into the library as a resident of the state of Indiana and conduct your research.
Were you able to have, like, back and forth with these individuals, or were they just sort of watching you?
First of all, I was, frankly, scared completely out of my mind. So it was sort of my get-out moment, mm-hmm. right? I'm referencing Jordan Peele's recent social-cultural horror film. I did very little talking. One of my cohort members did a lot of the talking and actually introduced himself to them. And it was an interesting moment because the way that this friend of mine did it, he saw these two gentlemen with Confederate belt buckles. They were looking up Malcolm X, and he stepped to them and said, "Hey, are you guys from the Klan?" And, of course, they first sort of sheepishly denied it. And then he said, "No, it's okay." He was sort of baiting them. He said, "It's okay. I'm a radical Black nationalist separatist. I don't want to live with you, and you don't want to live with me, so maybe we can agree on that." And then the guy said, "Yeah, you know, actually we are." And both of us got into a discussion with them beyond the Malcolm X piece about sort of what are they doing. And you learned that these guys are businessmen. They're property owners. It's not about sheets and three rows of teeth and, you know, and your cousin Clem and so forth and so on. These guys are in politics. They are getting degrees. They're professionals, they're lawyers, the whole thing. They are fully entrenched in society. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about American myths. One of the American myths is that, you know, the Klan is just this group of the illiterate white masses. That's inaccurate.
Good. Well, good stuff. A conversation will definitely be continuing in this normalization of Trump. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, and we will return after this musical break.
We'll be right back.
back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-hosts, Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Now we switch gears to talk about fake news. Just to give you an idea of the misconceptions that are caused by fake news, there's been a lot of polling data on these different beliefs that people hold that are just factually not true. So there's this claim that 3 million people illegally cast votes in the last presidential election. One poll that found that 46% of respondents actually believed that was true, even though there is no evidence to support that. There's also been a portion of the population that believe that Barack Obama was not born in Hawaii. Roughly around a fifth of the population believes that. There are also people, about 30% of the population believes that the number of people with health care has fallen since Obamacare, even though it's actually risen. Similarly, 41% of the population believes that unemployment rate has increased. That's actually decreased since 2009. About 23% of the population believes that the Dow Jones has fallen under the Obama era when it actually doubled under the Obama administration. And so this is just to give you a sample of sort of these, what I would call just the outcome of fake news. By listening to these things that are factually untrue, you have a large portion of the population that believe these things, and it's tough to combat that. And so our first guest on the show today has worked tirelessly in the field of media literacy to help people know the difference between fact and factless stories and news. Her name is Allison Butler, and Dr. Allison Butler is a lecturer, advisor, and the director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program in the Department of Communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in Amherst, Massachusetts. She teaches a course on cultural studies, critical media literacy, representations of education in media. Butler also directs the grassroots organization Mass Media Literacy, which you can find at massmedialiteracy.org. At Mass Media Literacy, she developed legislation, teacher training, and curriculum for the inclusion of critical media literacy in Massachusetts K-12 public schools. She holds a master's and a PhD from New York University. She's the author of numerous articles and two books on media literacy titled Media Education Goes to School in 2010 and Majoring in Change in 2012. Allison Butler, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Allison, tell our listeners about the work you do, how they can access it, and what are the goals of the work you do?
The work I do is to try and bring critical media literacy to as many conversations as we can have these days. I mean, I think our most recent election shows how important it is, but it's not just important in one subject area. It's not just important to do a critical analysis of the media or to learn critical production of the media. This is across our days. This is across our lives. This is across our subject matters when we're talking about K-12 schools. You know, there was a time in media literacy history where the thought was, let's build classes about production and let's build classes on media analysis. And I think where we are now is that we want those critical questions, that process, a continuous process of critical inquiry, to be in everything that we're teaching and in everything that we're learning. So one of my big goals is to try and make sure that we're asking those questions of critical inquiry. Who produced this text? For what purpose? What are we looking at or reading or listening to in the content? How do we see ourselves or not in the content? That we're asking those questions across our subject matters, that we're asking them in what might seem obvious in, say, English literature or social studies, but that we're asking them in science, you know, that we're asking them in math. To think about fake news and to think about some of the numbers that we've heard is to ask ourselves to critically assess polling data and to critically assess numbers that were given, to have a president that is opposed to any information or data on climate change is to ask questions of science. So my sort of big goal is to make sure that we're providing a space for our students, our teachers, our communities, our families to be able to ask these questions in any environment, in any space.
We saw a series of proposals that have come out of people suggesting what should be done to combat fake news. The Democrats and the House of Representatives put what I would call this largely symbolic bill on the floor that said they oppose fake news and that the United States should continue being a democracy instead of an autocracy. And then Facebook was pushing this plan to label and even censor certain news stories. Germany is considering fining companies that peddle false news. What are your feelings on these as potential solutions?
I think it's reactionary. I think that a lot of what we're looking at right now is reacting to the fact that we just don't know that much. And at the time that we're not knowing that much, we have so much information coming at us. I think to put something out there in the public by saying that people need to behave better or people in power need to be more responsible is the wrong way of looking at it. It's a reactionary response, and that's only going to get us so far. Part of what critical media literacy does is it's proactive. It invites us to engage with our texts, whatever those texts might be, from the beginning, not as a reaction. And so I think we need to be, and critical media literacy is primed to be ahead of the curve, not chasing after what went wrong.
Allison, this is Desiree. Because you are so immersed in education, how do you approach fake news in curriculum? Because I know that as a society, we tend to just go off of the consensus. So when we did think Earth was flat, the Earth was flat. Then it's not flat. It might be flat again if everybody agrees. So how do you approach that?
I guess I approach it from a couple of different ways. I mean, I will also be the first to admit if I'm working with high school or middle school students or librarians or teachers or families that this is really challenging for me too. I have a PhD in this. I've been studying this for a long time, and it's really hard for me as well. I don't necessarily have an easy answer, and I don't necessarily have an easy time of it when I'm reading the newspaper or watching something or trying to pay attention to something. It's really challenging. I think part of the reason why it's challenging these days is it's not entirely an argument about quantity, but there is just so much coming at us from so many different sources, and so much of our social media encourages us to go through them very quickly, right? It's super easy to scroll through Facebook so fast and see provocative headlines and not have to go any further than that. So I think one of our goals right now, and this is something that I try and bring to classrooms or to libraries, is to say that our job now is to slow down. It's to slow down our reading, to measure the information that we're getting. It's to acknowledge that it is really challenging. I think part of what we do to slow down is instead of accepting what we read, is to ask questions of it. And part of how I try to do this is I think of a scholar that was really influential on me and remained so when I was in graduate school. She's a British scholar. Her name is Angela McRobbie. And when she was doing her graduate work at the Birmingham School in Critical Cultural Studies, it was a sort of a new thing in post-World War II United Kingdom to study youth culture. And she was looking at her colleagues who were studying youth culture, and she pointed out, this isn't youth culture, this is boy culture. And so she was one of the first scholars to look at girls as legitimate cultural source. There's things that girls do. So it was in a way looking at it as this sort of, what might we forgetting? What might we missing? What are we not paying attention to? And so that's something that I try and bring to the work also, is we read these headlines or we hear this data, we see this, it's loud, it's flashy, it's bright. What are we not looking at? When our attention is directed to this big, bright light, this neon headline, what aren't we paying attention to, right? And to sort of use your example, when we believe that the consensus is that the Earth is flat, what aren't we looking at? What aren't we paying attention to? What are we possibly missing? And that's, I think, where critical media literacy can play a part, is that we might not necessarily walk out after an hour class period or even a semester class period and be like, okay, great, I've got all the answers right now. But we might walk out with some better questions to ask of the material with which we're engaging.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Nicholas Baham III and Desiree McSwain. And we are talking to Dr. Allison Butler about media literacy. It's worth noting Dr. Allison Butler actually sits on the Media Freedom Foundation board with Nick and myself. Allison, individuals who maybe do not have access to a formal education, what can you tell them about the materials you have available online and some recommendations you can make for people, maybe things to check out and things like that?
anybody can go to the mass media literacy website. Anybody can go to the Project Censored website. I think it's time for us to be looking on some level. I think looking outside of formal education is probably a really good thing, because this isn't necessarily about classroom learning. I am deeply invested in classroom learning. I personally think that classroom learning is really important, but I don't think it's the only place to learn. So I think it's part about finding our trusted resources, which is not easy. I don't mean to make that as like a flippant sort of really fast thing, but finding the trusted resources that ring true, that help us understand our communities, right? We look around our communities and we can see that there are things that are going well, and we can see that there are problems. By being in our communities, especially these days, we see posters either praising or critiquing the current administration. I happen to live in a part of the country that is very strong critiques of the current administration, and I see that beyond the walls of the classroom. We happen to be living in a time where people are doing postcard campaigns both for and against the current administration, where people are marching both for and against the current administration, and that's happening outside the walls of the classroom. So I think it's important to pay attention to what people are saying. I think it's time for us to be listening to human beings again. That doesn't mean that they're always right, but again, going back to that idea of slowing down, instead of scrolling through our social media, talking to our community members, I think we live in a time where those who are in power, it is in their best interest to keep us isolated, to keep us sort of alone with our computers or our mobile devices, to be scrolling through. And so our job is to engage with our communities, with our families, with our friends, to engage in conversations with our neighbors, and to find some resources that can help us ask these questions. There's a lot of places online that have really good documents, one-page documents that are simply a list of questions that help us figure out the potential honesty or dishonesty of a source that we're engaging.
Allison, this is Nick Bayham. It seems to me that we are living in a world of these new emerging discursive formations. And one of the ones that intrigues me the most and intrigues my students at Cal State East Bay is the whole discursive formation of the alt. So I get a lot of students who are asking me questions about, okay, what's the difference between a racist and an alt-racist? Is there an alt-homophobe versus a homophobe? You know, what's the difference? And I know that in the popular culture, to a degree, this term has been trivialized a lot. I'm trying to determine, and I really want your take on this, is that substantive at all? You know, what is the alt in your view? What's your critique of the alt? Is there really any difference between an alt racist and just what we know as a good old fashioned racist?
You know, I'm a child of the 90s. I miss when alternative meant that you, like, listened to Nirvana. The days where you didn't listen to the top 40 stations, so you were alternative. But no, I think that alt is an excuse. I think that alt is a cover word. I don't think, I mean, this is some ways that I try to talk about it in my classroom space. I don't think racism is an internal term, right? I don't think people walk around saying, I am racist. They will do racist things. They will say racist things. They will behave in racist ways, but that's an external label. And I think that what something like alt has done is put a little bit of a cover on a truth, that there is no alt racism, it's racism. And there is no alt homophobia, it is homophobia. But somehow adding those three little letters at the beginning softens it up in a way. I don't think that that's fair, and I don't think that that's true. I think it's just nobody wants to be called out on this kind of stuff, so the powers that be are making it easier. And I think our statistics, our numbers are showing this right now, that there has been an increase in attacks on, say, Jewish cemeteries. There have been an increase in attacks on African Americans, on Latinos, certainly on Muslims. Those numbers are going up, but they get couched in some other way of sort of having us look in the other direction. And I think alt is a way of looking in the other direction. We live in a time where racism has been rewarded by this president.
So along those lines, is 45 an alt president, or is he just, as we were discussing earlier, just a standard American corrupt politician like what we've had since the very founding of the country?
I don't think he's standard, but I do think he is a corrupt politician. Actually, I don't even think he's a politician. I do think he's corrupt. I have been trying to think about this a lot lately. I think he is 100% corrupt, but I really do wonder who's really holding the power in that administration. This is a man who is not a politician. He's never held political office before. He is a, for all intents and purposes, game show host, right? I mean, he's a reality show host. He's a real estate mogul. He's gone bankrupt multiple times. He's flash. He says outrageous stuff. He says unbelievable things and gets a lot of attention for them. You know, I think part of his rise to political popularity this past summer was he didn't spend a dime in commercials or advertising because he just got so much free press by saying such outrageous things. And I think while we are paying attention to him, because he now has this label of being president, lots of other stuff is happening behind the scenes that we're not invited to pay attention to. Politicians have lied since time began. Since there have been politicians, they have been lying. Since there have been, and not every politician, but since we began this political process, people have lied. Politicians have lied. Backroom deals have been made as soon as the backroom got built. But I think this is unprecedented.
So we're talking to Dr. Allison Butler, and Allison has work you can find at massmedialiteracy.org, and she also has work at gcml.org you can find as well. And Allison, we have to wrap this up in just a minute, but you were talking about the classroom, and I just have to ask, but before we end this interview, with the Betsy DeVos regime coming in, what impact do you think that'll have on the potential to have media literacy or critical media literacy in our public schools?
That woman makes me very, very nervous for the state of education, but my small silver lining hope, and my goodness, I might be naive about this, but my small silver lining hope is that she is so clueless that media literacy, critical media literacy, is actually going to be able to make some significant inroads because she won't know enough to pay attention to it. And that teachers and librarians are clamoring for this information. They're clamoring for this data right now. And if we can get our teachers and our librarians to start working, you know, in collaboration with each other and with their communities and with school districts across their states, their coasts, the nation, et cetera, we could probably start making some pretty significant inroads. She's going to have no idea how to pay any attention to this.
Allison Butler, you're always thoughtful, one of the best, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you all so much. This is really fabulous.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, and we'll be back after the musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Nicholas Baham III and Desiree McSwain. We continue our conversation about fake news and how citizens, individuals, and students can combat fake news with Dr. Bill Usman. Dr. Usman earned his doctorate in communication from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His area of focus is critical media studies. He is a former managing director of the Media Education Foundation and the current director of the graduate program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture at Sacred Heart University, where he is an assistant professor in the School of Communication and Media Arts. Bill's research focuses on media literacy education and the construction of racial ideologies in media, images, and narratives. He has published numerous essays in peer-reviewed journals and anthologies. His first book, Primetime Prisons on Television, Representation of Incarceration, was published in 2009. His recent book is The Spike Lee Enigma, Challenge and Incorporation in Media Culture, 2014. Bill, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me, Nolan. It's my pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you. So, Bill, why don't you tell our audience about the program you guys have going on at Sacred Heart University?
We have a master's degree program. As you know, it's called Media Literacy and Digital Culture. And it really is based in principles of critical media literacy education. You know, based on the idea that media play a really, really crucial role in shaping the world that we live in, you know, forming the basis for what we think, what we believe, how we see the world, and that it takes a high degree of media literacy to be able to navigate ourselves in that world. I think this fake news stuff that has all of a sudden come to people's attention is a prime example of why media literacy is important. So our goal and our mission is to educate the next wave of educators, activists, scholars, artists who are all working in this area of media literacy education. We think it's a great program. We have three different areas of emphasis, depending upon what people are interested in. We have one in children, health, and media. We have one in media and social justice. And we have one in political action and media production. That's what we're all about. We're all about challenging corporate media narratives and producing people who are autonomous critical thinkers.
So, Bill, can you give our listeners kind of an idea, those three different tracks of studies, can you give just maybe a tiny explanation of each track to give our listeners sort of what each track offers students?
Sure. No matter which track you're in, you take a certain number of core courses in the program, which are all based in media literacy principles. And then, depending upon what your particular area of interest is, you take these three course sequences which have a particular focus. So, for example, in the media and social justice concentration, you take a course on race and representation. You take one on gender identity and media. And you take one on media and social movements. That kind of supplements the other coursework that you're doing. In the political action and media production track, you do all of the regular media literacy courses, but then you also do courses creating your own media, whether it be video, podcasting, multimedia. It's all designed to put people out there who not only can critically analyze media institutions and messages, but can also create challenging alternative media of their own.
Your program is unique. I don't think there's anything like it in the country. Talk about some of the uniqueness of how students can get this degree quicker than most programs, and the content is unique as well.
Yeah, I think that's what you touch on. I mean, in terms of just the format of the program itself, it's a one-year master's degree. And the way that that works is you go year-round. We don't have a traditional summer break. And instead of semesters, we have eight-week modules. And students are taking two courses at a time throughout those 8 weeks to end up with the 36 credits that they need at the end of the year. So the good thing about that is it gets people really immersed in a very intense kind of way in the subject matter, but then a year later, they can emerge with a master's degree, which I think also makes it a little bit more financially accessible for people if you're in school for a year rather than 2 or 3 or 4 years. But it also is really about putting people out there who can then go on and do this education with others. In terms of the content, there are some other higher ed programs that have emerged since us that are doing media literacy programs. But, you know, there's a couple different versions of media literacy out there. There's the media literacy that CNN is starting to talk about, which is just very kind of individualistically based, very consumer based. We're going to create people who are better consumers of media. And then there's the critical media literacy approach, which is the approach that we take in our program, which is much more about social justice, activism, transformation, and challenging media institutions. It's not really the kind of media literacy that CNN would be endorsing, to be honest with you. It's a much more critically based form of media literacy that is about challenging the corporate power that's represented by these huge media institutions that play such a powerful role in shaping our world.
Bill, this is Desiree. I'm really intrigued by your most recent book title, The Spike Lee Enigma, Challenge and Incorporation in Media Culture. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I was always a big fan of Spike Lee films. I think he's a really innovative and exciting director. But the more kind of politically involved and politically conscious I became, the more I started to see things in his films that I found troubling in terms of gender representations, in terms of some of the kind of essentialist ways that he talks about race, in terms of, you know, kind of like an absence of a class analysis, in terms of some of the other work that he's done, you know, in advertising for Nike, advertising for the U.S. military. So I started to look at, you know, well, you know, who are these multiple Spike Lees out there? He's always represented in mainstream media as, you know, kind of this maverick, this radical, kind of fiery, like, voice of dissent. But is he really, when you really start to look at his career and when you really start to look at his films? So that's what I did. I kind of took a critical examination of his films, pointing out what I thought were really progressive and really beneficial aspects of his work, but also, you know, kind of challenging a little bit some of the representations that he puts out there and some of the work that he's done in the advertising industry.
Well, this is Nick Mayhem. Picking up on the Spike Lee discussion, I kind of feel the same way that you do. I had a chance to meet him when I was in grad school, and I always felt like he was a lot like the character that he plays in Mo Better Blues, Giant, who's sort of negotiating both a gambling addiction, and yet he has a really interesting critique of the music industry and how it's appropriating jazz. So for me, I think of Spike Lee, the documentarian, right, with Four Little Girls.
Right.
And then the piece about what happened in New Orleans around Katrina.
And the levees broke.
Right. And then the films. Exactly. Yeah. And also thinking about Spike Lee, the graduate of historically black college and university, Morehouse in particular, and yet the guy who put out a film that, frankly, a lot of people who went to historically black colleges and universities don't like.
School days, right.
Because it sort of bastardized what they conceive of as their frat culture, and also never showed any black people on campus studying.
Just partying, yeah. Yeah, I agree. He's a very complicated guy. My book is by no means a hit piece on him. There's a lot of things that he's done that I really admire a lot. And, you know, you point out the documentary film. One of the things I say in the book is look at some of his documentary work. He has done really amazingly progressive and critical pieces in his documentary films. And yet somehow, like, he's also able to make peace with, you know, working for Nike and working for the U.S. Navy. So that's where this title, the Spike Lee Enigma, comes from. How does someone themselves kind of resolve, like, having their foot in all of those different worlds? When the Levees Broke is just an amazing series of films that is really a devastating critique, I think, of U.S. capitalism and the neglect of the poor and the racial divisions in our society. But then you also look at how women are represented in this film. Basically, She's Got a Habit, his first film, it culminates in a rape scene that is never called rape and is never challenged. And the woman ends up kind of saying that it was her fault. And so really a very complex filmmaker, and I think a very complex individual, and that's really kind of what I wanted to explore in the book.
You know, that rape scene is very, as you say, Bill, very complex, because on the one level, it happens, the perpetrator is the character that you don't expect would commit the rape, right?
Right.
And to
he's
a
like
degree,
stand up, right, you know, corporate kind of guy, right?
Right. And to a certain degree, I mean, he's actually foreshadowing what we're now calling Hotep, right? The sort of righteous brother who pretends to give you this kind of PC angle, you know, and he's an activist. He really cares about you deeply, right?
A conscious con.
Exactly, a conscious con, right? And I think what Spike is suggesting is maybe even something that harks back to the films that the great Oscar Michaud made, which is within the black community, sometimes you got to watch out for the most conscious looking of folks. Those might be the real perpetrators.
No, I hear you. And I think there's also parallels to that in white so-called progressive circles. I've always been really critical of the kind of new age hippie guy puts himself out there as this Patagonia wearing, growing his own food kind of liberal, but then he's coming home and treating his own wife as a servant, or he's going to work for Chase Manhattan or something like that.
So you're listening to the Project Censored Show, and our guest is Dr. Bill Usman of Sacred Heart University. And we've got a nice flavor of the program, the graduate program at Sacred Heart University, as well as some of the content. Bill, I wonder if you could tell our listeners in the next just couple minutes here, some people are going to have concerns whenever, I'm sure you get this, whenever they're looking at a graduate program, people are thinking of employment, and also about when students can apply for the program.
One of the other things about our program is we don't have a firm and fast application deadline. We like people to apply as early in the year as possible, so that we can have a sense of our incoming class and we can look at some potential funding opportunities for people. But we start in August, and we really will accept applications right up until then, year-round. And then it's a challenging economic climate out there. We think that we provide people with a strong enough foundation that there's a wide variety of possibilities for them after they leave the program. We've got some people who are recent alums, who are teachers. We've got people who are working for nonprofit organizations. Someone just recently started doing some work for Global Citizen, a nonprofit organization. He's writing like op-eds for them and putting together different kind of materials. We've got someone who graduated from the program with a master's degree who just got offered a fellowship to Penn State to go on and get his doctorate in media studies. So we think there's a lot of paths once someone leaves our program, whether it's in nonprofit work, whether it's in activist and community organizing, whether it's in going on for a PhD, whether it's in education, whether it's working with youth groups. We think there's lots of opportunities out there for people who come out of our program.
We've been talking to Dr. Bill Usman. He is the director of the Graduate Program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture at Sacred Heart University. And if you like what you've heard here about the opportunities and just the small taste of the content you'll get in that wonderful program, I highly suggest you check out the Graduate Program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture at Sacred Heart University. Dr. Bill Usman, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you folks, too. I'm happy to come on anytime if you want to have me back and talk more about how this term fake news is being weaponized now by anyone in a position of power who doesn't like the media coverage that they're getting. I'm not going to say any names because it's hard for that name to come out of my mouth, but I'm happy to come back and talk about any of those issues with you anytime.
Absolutely. You're a friend of the show. Love to have you back. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks to all of you.
Let's get to our calendar of events for the Media Freedom Foundation and turn it over to Alicia Wajardo.
I'm Alicia Wajardo, and here is the calendar of events for the Media Freedom Foundation. On April 7th, Dr. Peter Phillips will be speaking at the Pacific Sociological Conference in Portland, Oregon. On April 20th, the PC crew, including Mickey Huff, Nolan Higdon, and numerous students, including myself, will be in Walnut Creek, California for an event hosted by the Peace and Justice Center. Go ahead on over to projectcensored.org for more details. I am Alicia Wajardo, and I hope to see you all at a Media Freedom event real soon.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Feminist Theology and Women in the Muslim World. Dr. Rifat Hassan is a Muslim theologian from Pakistan. She says that since anti-woman legislation and custom are enacted in the name of theology, it is necessary to study the Quran and critique the source. This required courage, since challenging traditional interpretation of the Quran can be a capital offense. On the other hand, we are all familiar with the claim that Islam has given women more rights than any other religious tradition, and Rifat Hassan decided to deal with that contradiction. Rifat Hassan began her quest in 1984 when her feminist friends in Pakistan asked her to help define the theological argument for women's liberation. That request changed her life. The events of 9/11 made her work much harder, but she continued to search for legislation inside Pakistan to help women, and she tried in many ways to promote understanding of Islam internationally. You are about to hear a rare TUC Radio Archive recording that I made of Rifat Hassan in April 1993 at UC Berkeley. I had never heard a purely theological argument for women's liberation and learned much about Islam that night. What touched me was the recognition how closely related Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are, making women of these three faiths the largest minority of any kind in the world. The basic myth of Adam and Eve is embedded in all three religions and is used by all of them to define woman as secondary, inferior, and sinful. In this talk, Rifat Hassan takes a closer look at the original story told in the Quran. And by the end of this program, your idea of Adam's identity, or who was first, and the whole issue of the rib will become thoroughly shaken. Get ready for some door slamming as some unhappy men in the audience left the auditorium. But first, get to know the person, Dr. Rifat Hassan.
Before I begin, I would like to greet all of you with the Islamic greetings, Assalamu alaikum, and to share with you, first of all, something of my own background and how I came to work in the area of women in the Islamic tradition. I have always known what it is to be a Muslim woman since I was born in a Sayyid Muslim family living in Lahore, a historic Muslim city in Pakistan, a country created in the name of Islam. But it was not until 1974 when I was teaching at Oklahoma State University in a place called Stillwater, which lives up to its name, that I started almost accidentally and rather reluctantly on my career as a theologian. Each year they would hold a seminar, and it was a custom that the faculty advisor would make a presentation. Now, generally speaking, the faculty advisor could speak on anything that he wanted to speak on. But in my case, I was assigned a specific subject. I was told to speak about women in Islam. Now, I felt a little bit affronted by this imposition of topic. It was apparent to me that I had been given this subject because the people who belonged to this chapter, who were mostly Arab Muslims, felt that I wasn't competent to speak about anything else, even though I taught them Islamic studies. And so they assigned to me this subject. However, I accepted this invitation for two reasons. One was that for the first time, this group had been put in a position where they had to have a woman speaker. This group would not allow women even in its audience. And so I felt that that in itself was a breakthrough. And the second reason was that I was so tired of reading book after book, article after article, brochure after brochure about women in Islam, all of them written by Muslim men. You have no idea how many there are. Now, my secret dream, of course, is to one day write something about the role and position and status of Muslim men or man in Islam. Because I'm becoming very concerned about the fact that nothing is written on this subject, and I sort of feel that there is no role or status or position of man in Islam. It's only women who have that honor. So I'd sort of like to do something in that regard. But anyhow, until I get there, I thought that it was important to study this question from a woman's perspective. I had studied the Quran, and I used the Quran as a textbook, in fact, in my courses on Islam. But I had not done a focused study of the Quranic passages dealing with women. I started to do that, to look deeper into these passages, particularly those passages which are controversial, more difficult passages. I do not know exactly at what time my academic study of women in Islam became a passionate quest for truth and justice on behalf of Muslim women. It happened when I realized the impact on my own life of the so-called Islamic ideas and attitudes regarding women. And I began to realize that so many things had happened to me in my own life because I had been born female in a Muslim society. So what began as a scholarly exercise became simultaneously an Odyssean venture in self-understanding. But enlightenment does not always bring endless bliss. And the more I saw the justice and compassion of God reflected in the Quran, the more anguished and angry I became seeing the injustice and inhumanity to which Muslim women in general are subjected in actual life. I began to feel strongly that it was my duty as part of the microscopic minority of educated Muslim women to do as much consciousness raising regarding the situation of Muslim women as I could. So this journey, which began in Stillwater, has been an arduous one and has taken me far and wide in pursuit of my quest. When I think of the situation of my sisters, who despite being the largest minority in the world, more than half of the 1 billion strong Muslim ummah, remain for the most part nameless, faceless, and voiceless, I know that there is no end to this journey in sight. Despite the fact that women such as Khadija and Aisha, wives of the Prophet Muhammad, and Rabia al-Basri, the outstanding Muslim Sufi saint, figure significantly in early Islam, the Islamic tradition has, by and large, remained rigidly patriarchal until the present time. Prohibiting the growth of scholarship among women, particularly in the realm of religious thought. This means that the sources on which the Islamic tradition is mainly based, namely the Quran, the Sunnah, the Hadith literature, and fiqh, have been interpreted only by Muslim men who have arrogated to themselves the task of defining the ontological, theological, sociological, and eschatological status of Muslim women. It is hardly surprising that until now the majority of Muslim women have accepted the situation passively, almost unaware of the extent to which their human, also their Islamic, in an ideal sense, rights have been violated by their male-dominated societies, which have continued to assert, glibly and tirelessly, that Islam has given women more rights than any other religious tradition. In recent times, largely due to the pressure of anti-women laws that are being promulgated under the cover of what is known as Islamization in some parts of the Muslim world, women with some degree of education and awareness are beginning to realize that religion is being used as an instrument of oppression rather than as a means of liberation. To understand the strong impetus to Islamize Muslim societies, especially with regard to women-related norms and values, it is necessary to know that of all the challenges confronting the Muslim world today, perhaps the greatest is that of modernity. Women, both educated and uneducated, who are participating in the national workforce and contributing towards national development, think and behave differently from women who have no sense of their individual identity or autonomy as active agents in history. Not too long ago, many women in Pakistan and also in other Islamic countries were jolted out of their dogmatic slumber by the enactment of laws as well as by threatened legislation, which was aimed to reduce them systematically, virtually mathematically, to less than men. In the face of both military dictatorship and religious autocracy, valiant efforts have been made by women's groups in Pakistan to protest against the instituting of manifestly anti-women laws and to highlight cases of gross injustice and brutality toward women. However, it is still not clearly and fully understood, even by many women activists in Pakistan as well as in other Muslim countries, that the negative ideas and attitudes pertaining to women that prevail in Muslim societies are in general rooted in theology, and that unless or until the theological foundations of the misogynistic and androcentric tendency in the Islamic tradition are demolished, Muslim women will continue to be brutalized and discriminated against despite improvement in statistics such as those on female education, employment, and social and political rights. In my judgment, the importance of developing what the West calls theology or feminist theology in the context of Islam is paramount today, with a view to liberating not only Muslim women but also Muslim men from unjust structures and laws that make a peer relationship between men and women impossible. It is good to know that in the last 100 years, there have been at least 2 significant Muslim men scholars and activists, Qasim Amin from Egypt and Mumtaz Ali from India, who have been strong advocates of women's rights. I remember how stricken I felt when I first began to see the glaring discrepancy between Islamic ideals and Muslim practice insofar as women are concerned. I set out to articulate what I considered to be the normative Islamic view of women. And in 1979, I wrote a monograph, which has never been published, called Women in the Quran, in which I gave a detailed exposition of those passages of the Quran which relate to women in various contexts. For example, women vis-a-vis God, women in the context of human creation in the story of the fall, women as daughters, wives, and mothers, women in the context of marriage, divorce, inheritance, segregation, veiling, witnessing to contract, economic rights, afterlife, etc. In particular, I focused attention upon those passages which were regarded as definitive in the context of man-woman relationship and upon which the alleged superiority of men to women rested. In 1983 and 84, I spent 2 years in Pakistan. Now, this happened to be a period of time when Islamization in Pakistan was at its peak, and a lot of laws, anti-women laws, were being enacted. And in the wake of these laws, a lot of brutality was being exhibited toward Muslim women. As a result of these oppressive laws, the feminist movement, or the women's movement, or the women's activist movement, was born in Pakistan. These women, for the most part, were Western-educated women, because those women were the only women who had the ability to lead any kind of a political movement in the country. And many of them were women with great character and courage, and they were able to take great personal risk in the face of martial law, which was prevailing in the country. But despite the fact that they were not lacking in courage or commitment, they felt that they were not succeeding in their struggle. And the reason why they were not succeeding in their struggle was because the laws that were being enacted in the country were being enacted in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of Islam. And a religious argument cannot be overturned by political action. A religious argument can only be overturned by a better religious argument. And so some of these women who happened to be my friends or who knew me asked me if I would help them. That was, for me, a historic moment of my life, because for 10 years, from 1974 to 1984, I had been doing this work essentially and primarily for myself. I was trying to make some sense out of my own life. But at this point, when I was asked by the women's groups in Pakistan to provide them with a theology and an ideology on which they could base their movement, this became for me a radically different situation, and I had to rethink virtually everything that I had done. I spent that summer thinking very hard about this issue and in reading 2 kinds of materials or 2 bodies of material. I did a systematic study of the 2 major hadith collections in Sunni Islam, namely Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Those 2 books are next in authority only to the Quran, as far as the Sunni Muslims are concerned. And I also spent time studying the work of some contemporary Jewish and Christian women and men, feminist theologians. And at the end of my period of study and reflection, I came to see that there are three assumptions which lie at the root of the attitudes, negative attitudes toward women, not only in the Islamic tradition, but also in the Jewish and Christian traditions. And these three assumptions are the following. First, that God's primary creation is man, not woman, since woman is believed to have been created from man's rib, hence is derivative and secondary ontologically. Second, that woman, not man, was the primary agent of what is described as the fall of man, or man's expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Hence, all daughters of Eve are to be regarded with hatred, suspicion, and contempt. And number three, that woman was created not only from man, but also for man, which makes her existence merely instrumental and not of fundamental importance. To me, the most important of these three questions is the first question, is the question of creation. The ordinary Muslim believes, as seriously as the ordinary Jew or Christian, that Adam was God's primary creation and Eve was made from Adam's rib. This belief is very strange, given the fact that there is no mention of the rib story in the Quran. Now, let me give a little bit of background of this rib story. There are in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, which is the opening book of the Bible, there are two creation stories. There's one creation story, which is given in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. This is attributed to a writer called the priestly writer who lived in the 5th century BCE. And the second story, which is given in chapter 2 of Genesis, verses 18 to 24, is attributed to a writer called the Yahvist writer who lived in the 10th century BCE, which is 500 years before the other writer. Now, the first creation story, or the one that's in chapter 1 of Genesis, is egalitarian, and it talks about God creating Ha'adam, which means the human in the image of God, creating it male and female and giving them dominion over the sea and the earth and so on. Whereas the second story, which is in the second chapter of Genesis, is the story that everybody knows about God creating Adam. Adam was lonely, and so God put Adam to sleep, and out of the rib of Adam, God created Eve. And the way that this story has been interpreted through the centuries has been very detrimental to women because, as I indicated before, it has led to the inference that God's primary creation was Adam, Adam in Hebrew, which is interpreted as being a male person. And so the male person becomes primary and the woman is derived from this male person and is secondary. Now, as the work of many feminist theologians indicates, the interpretation, the traditional interpretation of the story in what is generally referred to as the Judeo-Christian tradition, but mainly it is the Christian tradition, is erroneous because Adam in Hebrew does not mean a male person. The word Adam in Hebrew means the human. And so it's a generic word, it's a collective noun, and it refers to humanity as a whole. If one were to read the Bible in the Hebrew, which is the language of the Bible, the original language of what we call the Old Testament, then this would be self-evident. But to most people, most Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Adam is the name of a male person. Now, as far as the Quranic account of creation is concerned, there are two or three very interesting things that we need to note. First of all, we note that there are the word Adam is found 25 times in the Quran. The word Adam is not an Arabic word. It's a Hebrew word which has been co-opted into the Arabic language. Now, Arabic and Hebrew are, of course, sister languages. They are both Semitic languages. But since the word is originally Hebrew, it means the same thing in Arabic as it means in the Hebrew language, and it means, therefore, the human. It's very important and interesting to note that in the Quran there is no Eve. There is no Eve in the Quran. There is an Eve in the Islamic tradition called Hawa. Again, that's a Hebrew word, but there is no Eve in the Quran. And why should there be any Eve in the Quran if Adam represents humanity, which is what the word means? Now, there are 30 passages in the Quran which deal with the subject of human creation. Now, of course, the Quran is not structured like the Bible, and it's not chronological, and therefore you do not find all accounts of human creation in chapter 1 of the Quran. They are scattered throughout the Quran. But if you collect all these passages and you study them, you see that there are three generic terms that are used in these contexts. And these three generic terms are An-Nas, Al-Insan, and Bashar. And all three of these terms represent or refer to humanity as a whole. They do not refer to either male or female exclusively. As pointed out by Muhammad Iqbal, the outstanding Muslim poet philosopher of the 20th century, quote, "Indeed, in the verses which deal with the origin of man as a living being, the Quran uses the word Bashar or Insan, not Adam, which it reserves for man in his capacity of God's vicegerent on earth. The purpose of the Quran is further secured by the omission of proper names mentioned in the biblical narration, Adam and Eve. The word Adam is retained and used more as a concept than as the name of a concrete human individual. This use of the word is not without authority in the Quran itself." Now here we come to a very interesting situation, and that is that though there is no rib story in the Quran, and these 30 accounts of human creation that I have referred to, if you look at them, there is no mention in any of these passages of the creation of a male person prior to that of a female person. There's no such reference, no such implication possible if you study these passages accurately. However, if you ask an average Muslim any place in the world, and I've done this pop quiz in many places in the world, you ask a Muslim, how was Eve created? And the answer comes back without a batting of an eyelid, from the rib of Adam. I said, so you've been reading Genesis. The story is certainly not in the Quran. It's not a Quranic story. Not only is it not a Quranic story, but it is antithetical. It is against the teaching of the Quran on the subject of human creation. There is an expression in the Quran which is found in several passages, which is interpreted in a very interesting way. Chapter 4, which is Surah An-Nisa, chapter on women in the Quran, verse 1, it talks about the creation of humanity. God created humanity. And it goes on to say, خَلَقَكُمْ مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ. And God created all of you, in the plural, all of humanity, مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ, from one single nafs. Now, nafs is a word that's translated variously as self, as being, as entity, as person. There's a big discussion on it. So anyhow, for the time being, let's say it means being or entity. The other important thing is that in Arabic, every word is either masculine or feminine, and nafs happens to be feminine, grammatically. And so it says, and God created all of you from one single nafs, nafs being grammatically feminine. And then it goes on to say, وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجْهَا. And God created, مِنْهَا means from her, her going back to nafs, which is feminine, زَوْجْهَا, her mate. Now, what's very interesting, that's interesting, but what's more interesting, the reason I'm citing this, is because, for example, Yusuf Ali, whose Quran I have here, which is one of the most popular translations of the Quran, says here, O mankind, reverence your guardian Lord who created you from a single person, created of like nature his mate, and from them twins scattered like seeds countless men and women. Now, there is no question at all that Ha means her and not his. There is not a single translation of the Quran in any language which says that. I believe I have looked at over 100 translations in English alone, and I haven't found one that says that. most of them, I think over 95 or 96% say his. A couple, two or three maybe, that I have seen say it, its mate, which is better in some ways, but there is no it in the Arabic language. Now the question, this is a serious question from one point of view, because Muslims take the Quran very seriously. So why is it and how is it that these eminent scholars of Islam who undertake to translate the Quran presumed to correct the grammar of the Quran? Because how has this her become his? So this is just to give you a little flavor of how language, how the politics of language works and how important it is that by changing one single word, you turn the whole thing around.
That was Dr. Rifat Hassan, a Muslim theologian from Pakistan, recorded at UC Berkeley in April 1993. Come back when TUC Radio returns to see how the original story in the Quran was altered by later writers and translators. Rifat Hassan was professor of religious studies and humanities at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. She received her PhD from Durham University, UK in 1968 and has taught in many institutions, including Oklahoma State University and Harvard Divinity School. She retired in 2009 after 33 years of teaching. This was a rare TUC Radio Archive recording brought back for International Women's Month. Thank you for listening.
We are back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM. Actually, just like I said at the beginning of the program, we are at our very brand new website, which is cfmu.ca. We're broadcasting live to the whole world via the online podcasting service at cfmu.ca. Brand new. All our podcasts are up there now, too. Everything is all brand new, like we said at the intro. So check that out because it's this awesome new CFMU website. But I think we're joined on the line now by Montreal-based publisher Robin Philpott. Robin, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Brendan.
Oh, it's very good to hear from you. Robin, thanks for making time on the program. I know you've got a busy publishing schedule. There's so much happening with Baraka Books. I've gotten books in the mail. I've seen announcements, upcoming books. I can't even keep track anymore. You know, before we go into the whole Stephen Gowans thing, why don't you tell us, you know, what have you been publishing this year and at the end of last year?
Well, the more political books, we don't have just political books, but we do have, but we try to have political and historic books as well. In the fall last year, we published Songs Upon the Rivers, the buried history of the Canadien Métis in across North America, and it's a big book which goes back to the sources, and it just retells the story of North American history, and it's a book that's really three authors. One is a Métis guy, one is a guy from Franco-Albertan, another guy is an American from Seattle. And they cover this history, which basically people are unaware of, you know, that to what point the French and the Métis had been across the continent and had created this, and they'd intermarried and created peoples that are scattered. I mean, just as there's all these French names all across the continent, well, each one of these places, there are peoples. Then we published in the fall what's called the Prophetic Anti-Gallic Letters. And this It's an important book, which was written in 1836. And if your listeners know anything about Canadian history, they'll remember 1837 was the revolts in Upper and Lower Canada for basically Republican principles against the monarchy and against the British colonial authorities. And the leading newspaper in Canada at the time in Montreal was the Montreal Herald, and the editor-in-chief was a guy named Adam Thom. And so he wrote these letters, which he called the Anti-Gallic Letters, and it was published in book form, where it was just absolutely scurrilous. If you heard this story of Andrew Potter, who wrote this article about Quebec, which is absolutely contemptuous of everything that is in Quebec. Well, that the tradition started with, among other things, with this book, The Prophetic Anti-Gallic Letters, which the Anti-Gallic Letters were never republished. Yet the man was a very important man. He was co-author of the Durham Report, and that's the foundations of Canada. So those are two history books. We're putting out another one shortly. It's going to be Montreal City of Secrets, and it's the story, an unknown story, about the Montreal largely Anglo-British elite here and their alliance with the Confederate States during the Civil War. And all these actions, you know, John Wilkes Booth, the man who assassinated Lincoln, was in and out of Montreal regularly, and this is where the plan to kidnap him and to assassinate him was established, hatched and developed, was in Montreal. This is unknown. So this book will be coming out in the fall. So these are some of the books. We also have some fiction, Quebec fiction in translation, but it keeps us busy, let's say.
No,
so the big book, which we're really excited about, is I hope that your readers will get it. It's Stephen Gowan's, I would say, seminal work on the war on Syria. It's called Washington's Long War on Syria, and I know Stephen Gowan has sometimes been invited to your program. I think
that's right. Or,
yeah. So this book will be out in about 2 weeks. You can already pre-order it, and it's sparking interest all over the world. Just to give you an example, there will be a Chinese edition coming out from a Taiwan publisher that they got in touch with. They heard about Gowan's work, and they wanted to publish it. There's a Swedish publisher that is studying it and wants to bring out a Swedish edition. Turkish publisher as well. An Egyptian and Indonesian publishers are looking into it as well. So people realize that he's struck a chord in understanding what this war is all about.
Well, Gowans has a very popular international audience. You know, whenever we interview him and put it on a podcast, it gets huge amount of hits and likes. We call it the Gowans effect in Ontario. And you know, you go to his blog, his articles about whatever, Syria, North Korea, there's always a whole bunch of people come out of nowhere to like it. It's an international audience. And I think, as you say, they recognize that he's doing the hard work looking at the whole political economy and everything of a particular situation. And it's so easy to get endorsements as a result. I think that
one of his secrets is he has a dispassionate approach. He has a very rigorous, dispassionate approach, and he goes through the mainstream sources to make his case. And you know, you might even know of Sharmeen Nawani, who is an important journalist and political a Middle Eastern analyst of Middle East politics. And she wrote this, said, unlike so many hastily written books on Syria that miss the point, Stephen Gowan's work will prove to be an essential primer on the Syrian conflict for years to come. And she says it's a must read. Vanessa Bealey has said the same thing, who I think we are people who follow Syria know who she is. Eva Bartlett as well has made a wonderful comment about it. So it's I think that, you see, he sat down and said, well, where did this war come from? And that's one of the things. He takes it all apart. And it's by no means a book that's only pegged on what happened in Aleppo or, you know, what happened in 2011, although he goes right into each one of these questions, he gives it perspective. Basically, he points out that the United States, and Wall Street in particular, has targeted countries with publicly owned economies. And they are, in particular in the Middle East, they are what was known as the Arab Nationalist Movement, which is started among other with Nasser, and they were fiercely and are fiercely independent, and they've stuck to this independence, and so progressively the United States has basically tried to topple them all.
Well, one can't help but notice the accuracy of Gowen's thesis, because if you look at this series of wars that we know under the rubric of this war on terror, I mean, most of the countries that they're going after, most of these regime change operations, if not all of them, are countries that have exhibited some degree of independence from the Washington consensus. So Yugoslavia was actually the first before 9/11. And then they finally... after that, we're able to go after Iraq, change things in Afghanistan, totally remove the government and cause absolute chaos in Libya, and then follow on Syria. And you see that, I mean, these are not countries that are considered U.S. client states or U.S. allies or U.S. puppets. Those countries remain. If you're, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia, you get to stay in power, you know, despite rebellions against you in Bahrain and elsewhere. All of the loyal, subservient Gulf monarchs get to have powerful lobby organizations here and own newspapers in the United States and so on, and they get to have a carte blanche to repress demonstrations using weapons that we have provided them. And by we, I mean Canada and the United States. But Syria, Libya, and other countries have basically targets of very long-standing campaigns, and I think that's where Gowen's approach is very helpful.
Yeah, the thing that Stephen Gowans has done, he has taken apart methodically all the arguments that are invoked to justify the unjustifiable regime change. In other words, all the little arguments, all the things that make people in the left or people who are progressive, generally progressive-minding, trip. And he just takes them apart very methodically. You know, for example, the moderate rebel, he just takes that apart completely. He goes after the idea that, and which has come, I hear it on the radio in French and in English regularly, is that, well, it started out as a popular movement, a popular uprising. He just says no, and he explains it all, and he has all the references to it, and so that you go through there and say, well, how did I get tricked? How did people get tricked? You know, that's the strength of his talks. He doesn't talk down, you know, to people. I think it's excellent writing. It's the kind of thing. And he explains their history, the relationship in the colonial period, the post-colonial period. He talks about the use of Islamic terrorists, but he makes a very clear distinction between what would be anti-imperialist Muslims, particularly Iran, and the ones who ally with the imperialists, running out of Saudi Arabia, the royal dictatorships, as he calls them. And so it's... I think that it's going to be a book. It's a must-read for people to understand the whole world situation, relationship with Russia, and before that with the Soviet Union. I think it's an exciting book, and he's going to be launching it. He's so far is a four-city tour. First, he's launching in Ottawa next Wednesday at Carlton, Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Then he's going to be there in Hamilton. Now you know the details. Hamilton in a few weeks on the 25th.
That's right. It's going to be the April 25th, right here in Hamilton at 7 o'clock p.m. at the New Vision United Church, which is familiar people that went to the Eva Bartlett event. It's the same place, and it's at 7 o'clock p.m., so 24 Main Street West. But you can find all the information for that launch in more than one place. I would first go to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website. That's actually at just what I said, hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca or abbreviation HCSW.ca. And the very first item there is the book launch, Washington's Long War on Syria, and it has a poster for Hamilton specifically. There's a PDF that you can print out if you want to send it to your friends or whatever, or there's electronic information available there too at HCSW.ca. But I think Baraka Books is also providing information about the
Yeah, we've announced it. I mean, it's going to be in Ottawa. It's going to be Ottawa, Hamilton, then Toronto on April 27th. And Montreal here on May the 2nd. And Stephen made introduced Eva Bartlett in the Ottawa event when she was touring. And people were very impressed with his speech. So I think he makes an excellent presentation in addition to writing well. No.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he has a lot of practice, thanks to the Taylor Report, Unusual Sources. You know, I mean, a lot of the work that's in the book, we've seen hints of it elsewhere, from the reporting of Eva Bartlett and others to Gowan's own blog, where he addressed those issues that, as you said, the left, as such as it is, likes to trip on or stumble over. So they say, well, it was a piece started as peaceful protest, and they just wanted to get rid of neoliberalism, and they dropped barrel bombs on the protesters or whatever. But, you know, actually, it was from the very beginning a sectarian protests.
And
they were calling for the death of other Muslims, calling for pushing Alawites out, killing them, driving Christians to Beirut, and so on. And that's all documented. Like, they put it on their Facebook. It was in, Gulf regime media. Mm-hmm. And what Gowans has done, he says, look, let's look at the newspaper reports from the Gulf or from the Western reporting and other sources, videos that were uploaded. Here's what was actually happening at the beginning. And, you know, we were fed this whole thing because that was part of a campaign to convince left-wing people or people who identify as left to support another NATO regime change operation. And of course, most of the left did stumble over that. But now, I mean, there's been a sea change and people are recognizing the work done by people that wanted to look at the hard questions, even at the risk of being shunned from the wine and cheese circuit. So Gowans has built up quite a following now, along with others. And there's a whole sort of what you might call a real anti-war movement emerging all over the place to challenge all the propaganda that we've been exposed to. That's why I guess it was easy to get endorsements from Eva Bartlett and others because they recognize that work and have been doing
it. But the point is that there are, books are anyway, I'm publishing now because I realize the long-term importance of having solid books on issues. Books are like this, are made to last, and they're made to help people not make a mistake the next time around. For instance, everybody made a mistake on Libya. Everybody. Hopefully, we didn't. But the people voted in Canada. It was a United Party vote in favor of bombing and regime change. Well, this has got to stop sometime, and so. When you have books such as this one, and remember Max Forte's book we published, Slouching Towards CERT, on Libya, these books are like, it's like putting a, drawing a line and say, well, this is what happened, so we can't do this again. And so, I think his book is going to have that kind of effect.
Well, Max Forte's book that you published is one of the reasons why we have people critically investigating what's happening in Syria. because that book was popular and it had world attention. And people said, wait a minute, they lied that much and now they got some kind of operation in Syria. I better start looking into this myself, maybe write about it. And you know, it's thanks to you and Max Forte and others that we have that. Now, for those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Robin Philpott, a Montreal-based publisher with Baraka Books, who, of course, is publishing the upcoming book by Stephen Gowans, which is called Washington's Long War on Syria. And, of course, it'll be here in Hamilton, and we're very excited about that. Now, you know, in terms of the content and whether why books are important, I was talking about this with Stephen Gowans after a program once, and he said, you know, I just spent a lot of time writing a book, and he says, do people do this anymore? How important are books in this age of social media and all these other communications? And I said, well, of course, all of these new forms of communication are important, and they get information around very quickly, and people can argue with each other and so on. But ultimately, people's ideas, their thoughts, their comprehensive understanding of a subject comes from books. It comes from well-researched tomes in which someone has put together a coherent account of what has happened using information that's verifiable so that you actually have an argument upon which to rest your thoughts, your views, and your words. And I think that Stephen Gowans' book is going to be another, it's going to be like that. It's going to be a foundation for discussion about Syria.
Yeah, well, there's this great leftist writer, Jacques Ferrand, here in Quebec. He died 20 years ago or so, 25 years ago, but he was a leftist. He negotiated, helped settle some of the FLQ crises and stuff. He was a doctor. And he said, and I'll say it in French, le livre est le grand lieu de la contestation et il le restera. In other words, the book is the venue for contesting the status quo, and it will always be so. And I do think that that's true, because the modern ways of communication are absolutely indispensable, but to help people make a qualitative change in their outlooks, sometimes serious people want to be seriously convinced, and so long articles, of course, are very important. But a book like this, and I think that Stephen, he's aware of the ephemeral nature of articles. So that's why he said his hardest part in writing this book was the first week when he tried to figure out how he was going to do it. In other words, not to be just repeating what's in blogs and articles and so on. So and once he understood that, he said it flowed very, very well. And I, all I can say is congratulations to the man.
Yeah, no, he needed to identify important issues so that we don't get fooled again. And that's really the value of this book, and even in terms of monetary value, because I know that he's assembled footnotes and evidence documenting every aspect of his argument. So, when you use his book to explain a point to someone or to show why you're taking action and activism on a topic, you can get references for all the material that he's painstakingly collected, and it's not presented in an ugly way throughout the format of the text.
One of the things that we try and do at Baraka with the books is make it so that people can sit down and read without getting tripping over footnotes and losing the train of thought. So we put the footnotes in a way that you want more information, you want to get background, you want to see if he's backed himself up. Yes, he's got that, but it's not going to make you. You're going to be able to sit down and enjoy reading it, So that's one of, and he's got a good bibliography in it as well. So it's an, all I can do, I'm just a salesman, I guess, but is suggest that people get it and mull on the ideas that he presents in it.
Well, how do people get the book itself?
Well, the first thing, they can go to your launch, if they're one of the four cities, if your listeners are there in Hamilton, go to the Hamilton launch. You can buy it on-site on our website. And if you buy it, we have it now in stock. So if they buy it on the website now, barakabooks.com, it'll be mailed out immediately. So, in other words, you can get it there.
Want to be the first on the block to get that. I know people that are emailing me about it already. They're waiting.
Oh, good. So, anyway, it's But the other thing is go and hear Stephen talk at your launch, you know, and wherever in Toronto as well.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, one of the benefits of the fact that we live in this age of credentialism where everyone has to go to college and university is that, you know, people expect footnotes, they expect references, they expect research having been done on a topic. So when Gowans introduces himself into a controversial subject area like this, he has the backing and the research, and it's actually, it also shows the obsolescence of a lot of corporate media because they just present you information without citations, and, you know,
yeah.
U.S. officials said that blah, blah, blah happened. But
one of the things we try and avoid, and as publisher I try and avoid, is make it not an academic book. Because, you know, academic books are not made to be read. They're made to be cited. So this is a book that's made to be read. And I mean, with all the necessary backing and footnotes, we have them, but it is meant to be read. And you know, if somebody comes along with just a bunch of footnotes and wants to be cited, we don't publish it. It's got to be a read, you know, like something you enjoy reading. It's not a, like you know, telling a story accurately, or, you know, it's that's what people like, and it's to be able to sit down and enjoy understanding a subject. You know, if we're talking about nonfiction, so
I can't ask for a higher endorsement than that. But before we go, I just noticed I was checking out Ann Garrison's blog this morning, actually, and I saw that she actually interviewed you, and it was about one of your expertise areas, I suppose, and that is the events in Rwanda and the Great Lakes region in Africa. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Anne wrote an article, I think it was also for Black Agenda Report. It was called Israel's African Darling. Paul, yes.
Anne called me to do that interview because there's another book, but it was my book, and it was published by Baraka, called Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. And in it, she wanted me to discuss something that we pointed out in that book, was that 94 was when there was this taking, when the RPF took power and there was all the killings. 95, the Holocaust Memorial from Washington people and the Simon Wiesenthal people went to a conference in Kigali in Rwanda in order to, basically, that was when they started saying, well, you can use the word genocide as well in Rwanda. In other words, because Israel and the Zionists have been very jealously protecting that use of that word, because, they won't allow it for the Armenians because they're for political reasons, nor will they allow it, or do they like to hear it when we talk about indigenous peoples in Latin America, for instance, in Paraguay in particular. So they don't like it, but here they decided to share it. So that was one incident. And the second, this is the reason she happened to talk about it, was because Paul Kagame was invited to be the first African head of state to address the APAC. It's the American-Israeli...
Public Affairs Committee, I think?
Public Affairs Committee, very powerful, based in Washington, D.C. And Kagame, Paul Kagame, the president of... who's held power there basically for 22 years, was invited. And so the other event in that period in the 90s, that was in 95 when they had that conference, and they went there to teach the Rwandans how to memorialize the deaths. And then a year later, Kagame went to Israel in October 96. And this was just 2 weeks before Rwanda invaded the Congo, then it was called Zaire, and began this massive killing and removal of regime change in the Congo with American and British support. And he went to Israel and met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was Prime Minister then too, in 96. So there's a long-standing alliance. And Anne wanted to talk about that. And also, I tried to point out that this alliance began basically at the end of the 80s, when the Americans and 80s and about up to 1990, when Americans decided to identify what they called new African leaders, Museveni in Uganda, and Kagame eventually in Rwanda, and was a way of containing the Sudan. One of the goals of the Americans and Israelis is to weaken Arab states. And so they wanted to build up this, what you almost call mad dog regimes in Central Africa. And they've been basically holding sway. I mean, Museveni's in power, been there for 3 decades now. He fought to power, took over, and rules with an iron fist since 1986, and Kagame as well. And so that this is a long-standing alliance, and very similar in the way they operate. They're highly militarized governments, Rwanda and Israel. They lay down the law in the area, and they protect U.S. interests in the areas, whether it be Central Africa or in the Middle East.
Well,
that was about what the interview was about.
Yeah, Rwanda's been called the Israel of Africa.
Well, they like that. They like to call themselves that.
Yeah, I mean, Israel sure knows how to pick its friends in Africa. First, it was apartheid regime in South Africa, and now it's Kagame's dictatorship.
And Rwanda was the only African government to support invasion of Iraq. And it also supported the invasion of Libya, whereas even Uganda held off in supporting the Libyan invasion.
That's what it means to be a good U.S. client.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, you sure know your stuff on this. I encourage people to check out the interview between Ann Garrison and our guest Robin Philpott, which is available on Black Agenda Report and also Ann Garrison's blog. So we got to sign out, of course, but Baraka Books, that's at barakabooks.com, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they can order the book, but of course I should actually just go to the Gowans talk in Hamilton on April 25th and the other talks which are listed on the Baraka Books website. So thanks very much for your time. We'll get this out to our listeners as soon as we can via podcast. I know there's going to be a lot of promotion of Gowans' book because he has a lot of fans all over Canada, and there's going to be all sorts of ads, posters, interviews and stuff like that. So thanks very much again for being on the program today with us, Robin.
Okay, thanks for calling, Brendan.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.